The BBC presents The Sign of Four, a Sherlock Holmes story by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatized as a serial in five parts by Felix Felton. Episode 1, The Science of Deduction.
Good day. My name is Dr. Watson. I well remember that afternoon in 1888 when my friend Sherlock Holmes and I became engaged on the case we were afterwards to call The Sign of Four. We had had a good luncheon. At least I'd enjoyed it. But Holmes was listless and irritable throughout the meal. His long, nervous fingers beat a restless tattoo on the table as I tried to distract him with stories of my Afghan campaign. Later, when we returned to our Baker Street rooms, he started to fill his briar root pipe, then laid it aside, unlit, and picking up a monograph on Etruscan pottery, glanced idly through the pages. Finally, he put this aside, too, and took his violin from its case. Holmes, what is it, my dear fellow? Not your old craving again, I trust.
No, Watson, no. It's just that my mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems, give me work. The most abstruse cryptogram or the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my own proper sphere. I crave for mental exaltation. That's why I've chosen my own particular profession, or rather created it. I'm the only one in the world.
The only unofficial detective?
The only unofficial consulting detective. I am the last and highest court of appeal.
How do you mean?
When Gregson or Lestrade or Athelney Jones are out of their depth, which, by the way, is their normal state.
Quite.
Then the matter is laid before me. I examine the data as an expert and pronounce the specialist's opinion.
And claim no credit.
The work itself, the pleasure of finding a field for my peculiar powers, that's my reward. You remember my methods of work in the Jefferson Hope case?
Indeed, yes. I even embodied them in a small brochure with the somewhat fantastic title of A Study in Scott.
Yes, I glanced through it. Honestly, I can't congratulate you on it.
Oh? May I ask what's wrong with it?
Detection is, or ought to be, an exact science. And it should be treated in the same cold and unemotional manner.
You mean I've rather tinged it with, romanticism?
Exactly.
I must confess I was annoyed at this criticism of a work which had been designed specially to please him. More than once during the years I'd lived with him in Baker Street, I had observed that a small vanity underlay my companion's quiet and didactic manner. I made no remark, however, but sat nursing my wounded leg. I'd had a Giselle bullet through it some time before, and though it did not prevent me from walking, it ached wearily at every change of the weather. After a while, Holmes picked up his pipe again and lit it.
Here's a pleasant letter I had this morning.
Who from?
The French detective, François Leviard. I was able to help him in a little matter recently by referring him to a parallel case in Riga in 1857 and another in St. Louis in 1871. Have a look at it.
Magnifique. Tour de force? Why, he writes like a pupil to his master.
Oh, he rates my assistance too highly. He has considerable gifts himself. He has the power of observation. He has the power of deduction. All he lacks is knowledge, and that may come in time. He's translating my small works into French.
Your works?
Oh, didn't you know? I've been guilty of several monographs on technical subjects. Here's one of them, upon the distinction between the ashes of the various tobaccos.
Oh, and how many different kinds are there, then?
I enumerate 140.
140?
Indeed, yes. Sometimes it's a point of supreme importance. For example, if you can say definitely that a murder has been done by a man who was smoking an Indian lunkah, it obviously narrows your field of search.
Yes,
I suppose it does.
To the trained mind, there's as much difference between the black ash of a trichinopoly and the white fluff of bird's eye as there is between a cabbage and a potato.
You know, Holmes, you really have an extraordinary genius for minutiae.
I appreciate their importance, but I weary you with my hobby.
Oh, not in the least, but particularly since I've been able to watch the practical application. But there is one thing.
Yes?
You were speaking just now about observation and deduction. Well, surely one implies the other, doesn't it?
Oh, hardly. For example, observation shows me that you've been to the Wigmore Street post office this morning.
What?
But deduction lets me know that when you were there, you dispatched a telegram.
Good heavens.
Am I right?
Oh, absolutely right on all points. But for the life of me, I don't see how you arrived at it.
My dear Watson, it's so absurdly simple that an explanation is superfluous.
I can assure you it's not.
Oh. Well, then, observation tells me that you have a little reddish mold adhering to your instep.
Have I? Yes, so I have, but...
Just opposite the Wigmore Street office, they've taken up the pavement and thrown up some earth. It's difficult to avoid as you go in. The earth is of this peculiar reddish tint, which, as far as I know, is not found anywhere else in the neighborhood. So much is observation. The rest is deduction.
All right, then. How did you deduce the telegram?
Well, first, I knew you hadn't written a letter. I've been sitting opposite you all the morning. I can see stamps and postcards over there on your desk.
Mm-hmm.
So what else could you have gone to the post office for but to send a wire? Eliminate all other factors, and the one which remains must be the truth.
Yes, as you say, it is quite simple when you see it. Would you think me impertinent if I put your theories to a rather more severe test?
On the contrary. What is your problem?
Here is a watch that has recently come into my possession. Would you have the kindness to let me have your opinion on the character or habits of the late owner?
May I have it? Thank you. May I open the back?
Of course.
Pass me the convex lens, will you? Thank you. Yes. There are hardly any data. The watch has recently been cleaned, which robs me of my most suggestive facts.
You're right. It was cleaned before it was sent on to me.
All the same, my research hasn't been entirely barren. I should say that the watch belonged to your elder brother, who inherited it from your father.
I suppose you gathered that from the letters HW on the back.
Quite so. The W suggests your name. The date of the watch is 50 years back, and the initials are as old as the watch. So it was made for the last generation. Jewelry usually descends to the eldest son. And if I remember right, your father has been dead for many years. So it's been in the hands of your eldest brother.
Right so far. Anything else?
He was a man of untidy habits and careless. He was left with good prospects, but he threw away his chances. Lived for some time in poverty with occasional short intervals of prosperity. And finally took to drink and died. That's all I can gather.
Holmes, that's unworthy of you.
My dear fellow. What do you mean?
I could never have believed that you'd descend to this.
Descend to what?
You've made inquiries about my unhappy brother, and now you pretend to read it all from his own watch. Why, it's unkind. And, to speak plainly, it has a touch of charlatanism about it.
Oh, my dear doctor, pray accept my apologies. I do assure you I never even knew you had a brother until you handed me that watch.
Then how in the name of all that's wonderful did you get these facts? They're all absolutely true.
Ah, that's good luck. I could only say what was the balance of probability. I didn't expect to be as accurate as that.
Well, it all seems very strange to me.
Only because you don't observe the small facts upon which large inferences depend. For example, I began by saying your brother was careless.
Yes. How did you find that out?
Look at the lower part of the watch case. It's dinted in two places and cut and marked all over.
Oh.
He obviously kept other hard objects, such as coins and keys, in the same pocket. Surely it's no great feat to assume that any man who treats a 50-guinea watch like that must be a careless man. It's also fair to infer that a man who inherits a watch like that is pretty well provided for in other respects.
Well, where's the evidence of his, decline?
It's very customary for pawnbrokers in England, when they take a watch, to scratch the number of the ticket with a pinpoint on the inside of the case. My lens shows four such numbers inside the case. Inference that your brother was often in low water,
with occasional bursts of prosperity when he was able to redeem the pledge.
I see. And the drinking?
Look at the inner plate, where the keyhole is. What sober man's key could have scored those grooves? But you'll never find a drunkard's watch without them. He winds his watch at night and leaves these traces of his unsteady hand. Where's the mystery in all this?
It's as clear as daylight.
Holmes, I regret my injustice. I should have had more faith in you.
Oh, my dear fellow.
May I ask whether you have any professional inquiry on foot at the moment?
Nothing, hence my exasperation. I cannot live without brain work. What else is there to live for? Come over here to the window, Watson. Look at the yellow fog and the drab, dismal houses. What could be more hopelessly prosaic and material? What is the use of having powers when one has no field on which to exert them? Come in. Yes?
Excuse me, sir, but there's a young lady for you.
A young lady?
Yes, sir. She sent up a card.
Thank you. Miss Mary Morstan. I have no recollection of the name. Ask the young lady to step up, Mrs. Hudson.
Very good, sir.
Perhaps you'd like me to...
No, don't go, Doctor. I prefer you to remain.
In a moment, there was a step on the stair, and Miss Morstan entered the room. She was a blonde young lady, small, dainty, well-gloved, and dressed in the most perfect taste. In an experience of women which extends over many nations and three separate continents, I have never looked upon a face which gave a clearer promise of a refined and sensitive nature. As she took the seat which Sherlock Holmes placed for her, her hand quivered and her lip trembled.
Mr. Holmes, you once gave some help to my employer, Mrs. Cecil Forrester. That's why I've come to you.
Mrs. Cecil Forrester. I believe I was of some slight service to her. As far as I remember, the case was a very simple one.
Oh, she didn't think so. Anyway, you can't say the same of mine.
Indeed?
Truly, I can't think of anything more strange than the situation I find myself in. It's utterly impossible to explain.
State your case.
I say, I really do feel I ought not to be here, if you'll excuse me.
Oh, no, please. Mr. Holmes, if your friend would be good enough to stop, he might be of inestimable service to us.
Oh, well, if that's really your wish, of course I... thank you.
Now, Miss Morstan.
Well, briefly, the facts are these. My father was an officer in an Indian regiment.
Oh, really?
Yes, and he sent me home when I was quite a child. My mother was dead and I had no relative in England, so I was placed in a boarding school at Edinburgh and stayed there till I was 17. Then my father got 12 months' leave and came home.
How long ago was this, Miss Morstan?
Nearly 10 years.
10 years?
My father telegraphed to me from London that he'd arrived safely and told me to come down at once. He was staying at the Langham Hotel.
So you came to London?
Yes, and drove to the Langham. And there I was informed that Captain Morstan was staying there, but that he'd gone out the night before and not returned. I waited all day, but there was no news of him. So that night I went to the manager of the hotel. He put me in touch with the police, and next morning we advertised in all the papers.
With what result?
None. From that day to this, no word has ever been heard of my unfortunate father.
You and me.
He came home with his heart full of hope, to find some peace, some comfort. And instead...
Miss Morstan.
The date?
He disappeared on the 3rd of December, 1878. Well, nearly 10 years ago, as I say.
His luggage?
It stayed at the hotel.
Was there anything in it to suggest any clue?
No. Some books, some clothes, and a number of curiosities from the Andaman Islands.
The Andaman Islands?
Yes. He'd been one of the officers in charge of the convict guard there.
Had he any friends in town?
Only one that we know of. Major Sholto of his own regiment.
Which regiment was it, Miss Morstan?
The 34th Bombay Infantry.
Ah.
The major had retired some little time before and lived at Upper Norwood. We communicated with him, of course, but he didn't know that his brother officer was in England.
A singular case.
But I haven't yet told you the most singular part of it.
Pray do, then.
About 6 years ago, an advertisement appeared in the Times asking for the address of Miss Mary Morstan and saying it would be to her advantage to come forward. There was no name or address.
Have you the exact date?
Yes, the 4th of May, 1882.
Thank you.
At that time, I had just entered Mrs. Forrester's family as a governess, and she advised me to publish my address in the advertisement column. Mr. Holmes, the same day, a small cardboard box was sent to me through the post, and inside was a large and lustrous pearl.
With no message?
Nothing. And since then, every year on the same date, a similar box has arrived containing a similar pearl, with no clue where it has come from.
Have you had these pearls examined?
Oh, I have indeed. An expert says they're of a very rare variety and very valuable. They're certainly very handsome. You can see them for yourselves. I've brought them with me.
Well, I must say, upon my word, those are some of the finest pearls I've ever seen.
Thank you. Your statement is most interesting, Miss Morstan. Tell me, has anything else occurred to you?
Yes. It happened today. That's why I've come to you.
What happened?
This letter arrived this morning. Perhaps you'd like to read it for yourself.
Thank you. The envelope, too, please. Postmark, London, Southwest. Date, November the 7th. Man's thumb mark on the corner. Probably the postman. Best quality paper. Envelopes at sixpence a packet. Particular man in his stationery. No address.
Well, what does it say, Holmes?
It says, be at the third pillar from the left outside the Lyceum Theatre tonight at 7 o'clock. If you are distrustful, bring two friends. You are a wronged woman and shall have justice. Do not bring the police. If you do, all will be in vain. Your unknown friend. Well, really, this is a very pretty little mystery. What do you intend to do, Miss Morstan?
That is exactly what I want to ask you.
Then we shall most certainly go. You and I and... Why, yes, Dr. Watson's the very man. Your correspondent said two friends. He and I have worked together before.
But would he come?
Madam, I shall be proud and happy if I can be of any service.
You are both very kind. I have led a retired life and have no friends to appeal to. If I'm here at 6, it will do, I suppose.
You mustn't be later. There is one other point, though. Is the handwriting of this letter the same as that on the pearl box addresses?
I have them all here. You can compare them.
You really are a model client.
She is, indeed.
You have the correct intuition. Let us see now. Yes, they're disguised hands, except the letter. But there's no question who wrote them. Look how that irrepressible Greek E breaks out. Look at the twirl of the final S. They're undoubtedly by the same person. I shouldn't like to suggest false hopes, Miss Morstan, but is there any resemblance between this hand and your father's?
Nothing could be more unlike it.
I expected to hear you say so. We'll expect you then at 6. Pray let me keep the papers.
Of course.
I may look into the matter before then. It's only 3:30. Au revoir, then.
Au revoir. Au revoir, Dr. Watson.
Well, goodbye till 6 o'clock. My word. What a very attractive woman.
Is she? I didn't observe.
Really, Holmes, there's something positively inhuman in you at times.
It is of the first importance not to let your judgment be biased by personal qualities. A client to me is a mere unit. A factor in a problem.
So I see.
The emotional qualities are antagonistic to clear reasoning. I assure you that the most winning woman I ever knew was hanged for poisoning 3 little children for their insurance money.
But in this case,
I never make exceptions. They disprove the rule. What do you make of this fellow's handwriting?
It's legible and regular. I see him as a man of business habits and some force of character.
Oh, no, Watson, no, that won't do. Look at his long letters. They hardly rise above the common herd. That D might be an E-A, and that L might be an E.
Well, what does that tell you?
Men of character may write illegibly, but they always differentiate their long letters. And look at his K's. There's vacillation there, and self-esteem in his capitals. I'm going out now.
Am I to come with you?
No, pray don't bother. I just have a few references to make. Let me recommend this book. One of the most remarkable ever penned. It's Winwood Reade's Martyrdom of Man. I shall be back in an hour.
I sat at the window with a volume in my hand. My thoughts ran upon our late visitor. Her smiles,
her voice, and the strange mystery which overhung her life. If she was 17 at the time of her father's disappearance, she must be 27 now. A sweet age, when youth has become a little sobered by experience. So I mused, until such dangerous thoughts came into my head that I hurried away to my desk and plunged furiously into the latest treatise on pathology. What was I, an army surgeon with a weak leg and a weaker banking account, that I should dare to think of such things?
Well, Watson.
Hello. How did you get off?
Splendidly. There's no great mystery in this matter.
A cup of tea.
Thank you. The facts appear to admit of only one explanation.
What? You've solved it already.
Well, that would be to say too much. I've discovered a suggestive fact, that is all.
What is it?
I've just found from the back files of the Times that Major Sholto of Upper Norwood, late of the 34th Bombay Infantry, died on the 28th of April, 1882.
I may be very obtuse, Holmes, but I fail to see what that suggests.
No? You surprise me. Look at it this way, then. Captain Morstan disappears. The only person in London he could have visited is Major Sholto. Major Sholto denies having heard that he was in London. 4 years later, Sholto dies.
Well?
Within a week of his death, Captain Morstan's daughter receives a valuable present, which is repeated from year to year, and now culminates in a letter which describes her as a wrong woman. Do you begin to see it?
Yes, I think I do.
What wrong can the letter refer to except this deprivation of her father? And why should the presents begin immediately after Sholto's death, unless Sholto's heir knows something of the mystery and wishes to make compensation? Have you any alternative theory which will meet the facts?
No. But why should he write a letter now rather than 6 years ago? Again, the letter speaks of justice. Well, what justice can she have now? It's too much to suppose that her father's still alive.
There are certainly difficulties, but our expedition of tonight will solve them all. Ah, here's a four-wheeler and Miss Morstan inside, no doubt. Are you ready?
Yes.
I shall bring your heavy stick, and I shall take my revolver.
Oh, you think our night's work may be as serious as that?
For all we know. Come along, we better go down. It's a little past the hour.
Miss Morstan was muffled in a dark cloak, and her sensitive face was composed but pale. She must have been more than woman if she did not feel some uneasiness at our strange enterprise. But her self-control was perfect, and she readily answered the few additional questions that Holmes put to her.
Oh, yes, Major Sholto was a very particular friend of Papa's. He and Papa were in command of the troops in the Andaman Islands, so they were thrown together a great deal.
I see.
By the way, a curious paper was found in Papa's desk which no one could understand.
A paper?
Yes. I've brought it with me, in case you care to see it.
I should indeed. Hold this pocket lantern for me, Watson. That's it. Now. It's a paper of native Indian manufacture. At some time it has been pinned to a wall.
It's some sort of diagram, surely.
Yes. Yes, it seems to be the plan of part of some large building with halls and corridors and passages. There's a small cross in red ink there, and something in pencil just above it. Let's have the lantern a bit closer. Yes. It says 3.37 from left. Whatever that means.
Well, what's that hieroglyphic affair in the left-hand corner?
Ah, yes. Four crosses in a line with their arms touching. And look what's written beside it. The sign of the four. Jonathan Small, Mohammed Singh, Abdullah Khan, Dost Akbar.
I really don't see how this bit of paper bears on the matter.
No, nor do I. Yet it's obviously a document of importance. It's been carefully kept in a pocketbook, one side as clean as the other.
It was in his pocketbook when we found it.
Keep it carefully, Miss Morstan. It may prove of use to us. I begin to suspect that this matter may turn out to be much deeper and more subtle than I thought. I must reconsider my ideas.
The day had been a dreary one, and a dense, drizzly fog lay low on the great city. Down the Strand, the yellow glare from the shop windows
threw a murky, shifting radiance across the crowded thoroughfare. There was, to my mind, something eerie and ghost-like in the endless procession of faces which flitted across these narrow bars of light and back into the gloom once more.
Here's the Lyceum. What a time our friend has chosen for the rendezvous. Everyone's just arrived into the theatre. Make for the third pillar, driver.
Do me best, sir.
Look at the chef trunks and the dams. Well, who knows? We may be in for a more exciting evening than they are.
This do, sir?
Yes.
Excuse me, sir. Are you the parties who come with Miss Morstan?
I am Miss Morstan, and these two gentlemen are my friends.
You will pardon me, miss, but I was to ask you to give me your word that neither of your companions is a police officer.
I give you my word.
All right, then. See that cab the boy's leading over? I'll ask you to leave this one and go over to that one. Then I'll drive you myself.
May we know where we're going?
I'm afraid not, sir.
Very well. Watson, help Miss Morstan across. I'll pay our cabman off and join you.
We had hardly taken our places in the second four-wheeler before the man who had addressed us mounted to his box, whipped up his horse, and we were plunging away at a furious pace through the crowded streets. We were driving to an unknown place on an unknown errand. And what with our pace and the fog and my own limited knowledge of London, I'd soon lost my bearings.
Any idea where we are, Holmes?
I know exactly. We've come by Rochester Row and Vincent Square. Now we're in the Vauxhall Bridge Road. We're making for the Surrey side, apparently. Yes, I thought so. Now we're on the bridge.
We did indeed get a fleeting view of a stretch of the Thames, with the lamps shining on the broad, silent river. But our cab dashed on and was soon involved in a labyrinth of streets on the other side. Wandsworth Road, Priory Road, Stockwell Place, Cold Harbour Lane.
Our quest doesn't appear to take us into very fashionable regions.
Holmes, do you think this may all be part of some ridiculous hoax?
No, I do not. People don't send valuable pearls as a joke, and whoever invited us on this errand sent Miss Morstan those pearls. There's one thing puzzling me particularly, Watson.
What's that?
Our driver's face. I've seen it somewhere, but I can't place it.
I'm afraid it doesn't mean anything to me. How are you feeling, Miss Morstan?
I can't say I care for this neighborhood.
I quite agree. It's forbidding in the extreme, eh, Holmes?
It is indeed. Little wonder that crime breeds in this murk and squalor.
Then came rows of two-storied villas, each with a frontage of miniature garden. And then again, interminable lines of new, staring brick buildings. The monster tentacles that the giant city was throwing out into the country. Until at last, the cab drew up at the third house near the terrace.
We're there, Miss Morstan. Will you and your friend step out, please?
Ah, certainly. Take my hand, Miss Morstan.
Thank you.
Holmes?
Don't bother, my dear fellow.
All these houses look uninhabited.
Not this one. At least there's a glimmer of light in the kitchen window.
Oh, he's there, sir. Chafing he'll be, though I'll come as quick as I could. Will you please to follow me?
The coachman guided us with his lantern to the front door. On our knocking, the door was instantly thrown open, showing the dim, sordid hallway that the outside of the house suggested. But standing there to receive us was a strangely incongruous figure. A tall Hindu servant. In a yellow turban, white loose-fitting clothes, and a yellow sash.
Miss Morstan?
I am Miss Morstan, and these are my friends.
The Sahib awaits you. I will warn him of your arrival.
That ends the first episode of The Sign of Four by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, adapted for broadcasting by Felix Felton, with Richard Herndl as Sherlock Holmes and Brian Coleman as Watson. Production for the BBC by Archie Campbell. The BBC presents The Sign of Four, a Sherlock Holmes story by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, adapted as a serial for radio in five episodes by Felix Felton. The story is told as usual by Sherlock Holmes' friend and assistant, Dr. Watson. Episode 2, The Tragedy of Pondicherry Lodge.
Good day to you. When the beautiful Miss Mary Morstan called at our Baker Street rooms one September afternoon in 1888, she brought us a curious story. How her father, on leave from India, had disappeared from a London hotel 10 years ago and never been seen again. How, following the death 4 years later of her father's friend, Major Sholto, she had been sent a valuable pearl on the same day every year. And how, on the morning of her visit to us, she had received a mysterious request to be outside the Lyceum Theatre at 7 o'clock that evening with two friends. Sherlock Holmes and I had accompanied her, and a four-wheeler had whisked us across the river and through the dingy South London streets until we had come to a commonplace little house in a new terrace. There, the door had been opened by a tall Hindu servant.
Miss Morstan?
I am Miss Morstan, and these are my friends.
The Saab awaits you. I will warn him of your arrival. You follow me, please.
The Indian led us down a narrow, somewhat dingy passage until he came to a door which he threw open and motioned us in. The room was as out of place as a diamond in a setting of brass. Rich curtains and tapestries draped the walls. The carpet was of amber and black with great tiger skins thrown across it. A huge hookah stood on a mat, filling the room with a subtle aromatic odor. And standing amidst this eastern luxury was a small man with a high, bald head, fringed with a bristle of red hair, whose hands and features were in a perpetual jerk.
Your servant, Miss Morstan. Your servant, gentlemen. Pray step into my little sanctum.
Thank you.
A small place, but furnished to my own liking. An oasis of art in the howling desert of South London.
May we ask whom we have the honor of addressing?
Mr. Thaddeus Sholto, that is my name. You are Miss Morstan, of course.
Yes.
And these gentlemen...
This is Mr. Sherlock Holmes, and this is Dr. Watson.
Oh, a doctor, eh? Oh, have you your stethoscope with you, sir?
Yes, never without it.
Well, might I ask, then... Would you have the kindness...
What is it?
I have grave doubts as to my mitral valve, if it would be so very good. The aortic I can rely on, but I should value your opinion on the mitral.
Oh, well, certainly, if you wish it. Will you excuse us, Miss Morstan?
Certainly.
Just come over here, sir.
Thank you.
Well, now, open your shirt, please. That's it. Now breathe. Again. Appears to be quite normal. Oh. I don't think you have any cause for uneasiness.
Oh, thank you. You'll excuse my anxiety, Miss Morstan. I'm a great sufferer, and I've long had suspicions of that valve. I'm delighted to hear that they're unwarranted. Had your father, Miss Morstan, refrained from throwing a strain on his heart, he might have been alive now.
Really, sir? What a callous thing to say in front of his own daughter. Have you no feelings?
Doctor, please. It doesn't matter. I knew in my heart he was dead.
I can tell you just what happened. And what is more, I can do you justice. And I will, too. Whatever Brother Bartholomew may say.
Brother Bartholomew?
My twin.
Oh.
Miss Morstan, I'm so glad to have your friends here. Not only as an escort to you, but also as witnesses to what I'm about to do and say. The three of us can show a bold front to Brother Bartholomew. But let us have no outsiders. No police or officials. Nothing would annoy Brother Bartholomew more than any publicity.
For my part, whatever you choose to say will go no further. I say the same.
Well, that's well, that's well. Now, may I offer you a glass of Chianti, Miss Morstan, or of Tokai? I keep no other wine.
Not for me.
Gentlemen?
No, thank you.
Well, then, I trust you have no objection to the odor of Eastern tobacco. I am a little nervous, and I find my hookah an invaluable sedative. Forgive me. Now, When I first decided to communicate with you, Miss Marston, I might have given you my address.
Why didn't you?
Well, I was afraid you would disregard my request and bring unpleasant people with you. So I took the liberty of arranging the appointment in such a way that my man Williams could see you first. You will excuse these precautions, but I am a man of retiring, I might even say refined tastes, and there is nothing more unaesthetic than a policeman. Do you like my treasures? That landscape is a genuine coro. A connoisseur might perhaps throw doubt on that Salvador Rosa, but there can be no doubt about the bouquero. And as for
Mr.
the...
Mr. Sholto.
Yes?
You will excuse me, but I'm here at your request to learn something that you wish to tell me. It's getting late.
Yes. Well, I'm afraid it's bound to take a little time. You see, we shall have to go to Norwood.
Norwood? Why?
To meet Brother Bartholomew, of course.
Your twin?
Yes. We must see if we can get the better of him. He's very angry with me for what I've done. I had quite high words with him last night. You can't imagine what a terrible fellow he is when he's angry.
If we've got to go to Norwood, perhaps it'd be as well if we started at once.
Oh, no. Oh, dear me, no, no, no. That wouldn't do at all. No, I must prepare you by showing you how we all stand to each other. There are several points in the story that I can't fathom myself. I can only tell you what I myself know.
One question before you begin.
Yes?
Are we to assume that you and your brother are the sons of Major John Sholto, late of the Indian Army?
Yes, that's quite right. My father retired some 11 years ago and came to live at Pondicherry Lodge in Upper Norwood. He'd done well in India and brought back with him a great deal of money, a lot of valuable curiosities, and a staff of native servants. Bartholomew and I were the only children. We lived in great luxury.
You were living with your father then when Captain Morstan disappeared?
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember it well. We read the details in the papers and discussed it freely with father. He used to join in our speculations about it. We never for a moment suspected that he was the one man who knew what had really happened.
I see.
We did realize, of course, that some mystery, some danger overhung our father.
How did you know that?
Because he was fearful of going out alone. He had two prize fighters to act as porters at Pondicherry Lodge. Williams, who drove you tonight, was one of them. He was once lightweight champion of England.
So that's it. I thought I knew the fellow's face.
And do you know what it was your father feared, Mr. Sholto?
No. He would never tell us. All we knew was that he had a marked aversion to men with wooden legs.
Wooden legs?
Yes, and on one occasion he actually fired a revolver at a wooden-legged man who proved to be a harmless tradesman canvassing for orders. We had to pay a large sum of money to hush the matter up.
You never discovered any reason for your father's peculiar aversion to men with wooden legs?
Well, we used to think it was a mere whim, but events made us change our opinion.
Oh?
Yes. Early in 1882... my father received a letter from India. It was a great shock to him. He nearly fainted at the breakfast table when he opened it. And from that day, he sickened to his death.
What was in the letter?
We never discovered. All I could see was that it was short and written in a scrawling hand. My father had suffered for years from increasing ill health, and now he became rapidly worse. And towards the end of April, we were told that he was beyond all hope. Bartholomew and I were summoned to his bedside. He was propped up with pillows and breathing heavily. He made us lock the door, and then we came to either side of the bed, and he grasped our hands.
My sons, there is one thing weighing on my mind. It is my treatment of poor Morstan's orphan. Half the treasure should have been hers. I have kept it from her. Thaddeus?
Yes, father?
You see that chaplet by the quinine bottle?
Yes.
Hand it to me. See, it is tipped with pearls, large, rare pearls. This at least I got out to send her, but my avarice stood in the way. You, my sons, will give her a fair share of the Agra treasure, but send her nothing, not even the chaplet, until I am gone.
For a little while, my father could not continue. But then he gathered strength and began to speak of Captain Morstan. It seems that for years the captain had suffered from a weak heart, but he had concealed it from everyone. Only my father knew it. They had worked very closely in India, and through a remarkable chain of circumstances, they had come into possession of a considerable treasure. My father brought it over to England and when Captain Morstan arrived, he went straight over to Pondicherry Lodge to claim his share. What happened that night, we learned from my dying father as we sat at his bedside.
We could not agree how to divide the treasure. There was a quarrel. We came to heated words. Morstan sprang from his chair in a paroxysm of anger. Then he turned a sickly color, pressed his hand to his side, and fell backwards, cutting his head against the corner of the treasure chest. I stooped over him, and...
Yes, Father?
I saw that he was dead. For a long time, I sat there. I couldn't call for help.
But why not, Father? You didn't kill him.
It looked black enough against me, don't you see? An inquiry would have meant revealing the treasure. Austin had told me that no one on earth knew where he had gone. Why should anyone ever know? Then my faithful old servant, Lal Chadha, helped me to dispose of the body that night. But it wasn't just that I concealed the body. I concealed the treasure, too. My sons, I wish you to make restitution. Come closer. The treasure is hidden in... No! No! Keep him out! For mercy's sake, keep him out! Keep him out!
My father was staring at the window. We both swung round to it. There was a face looking in out of the darkness. A bearded, hairy face with wild, cruel eyes. We rushed to the window, but the man was gone. We turned back to my father. His head had dropped, and his pulse had ceased to beat. That is the story, Miss Morstan, of how your father died and mine.
Did you search the garden for this intruder, Mr. Sholto?
Indeed we did, but we found nothing except for a single footmark in the flower bed.
A single footmark?
Yes, but for this, we might have thought our imaginations had conjured up that wild face. However, we soon had further proof that secret agencies were at work around us.
In what way?
In the morning, we found the windows of my father's room open. His cupboards and boxes had been rifled, and across his chest was a torn piece of paper with the words, "The Sign of the Four," scrawled on it.
Ah! And can you tell us what those words mean?
No. We never knew, my brother and I. And we never learned any more about the secret intruder.
Had anything been stolen?
Nothing as far as we could judge, though everything had been turned out.
Mr. Sholto, you mentioned that the only trace left by the intruder was a single footmark.
Yes.
You also spoke earlier of your father's curious aversion to one-legged men. I am suggesting that your most unusual visitor on this occasion was such a man.
A man with a wooden leg. Yes, that is possible, I suppose. Naturally, we associated the incident in some way with the fear that haunted my father, but, well, one-legged man or no, it still remains a complete mystery to us. Oh, forgive me. I have let my hookah go out. I must relight it.
Miss Morstan, all this must be very painful for you. Is there anything I can do? A glass of water?
No. No, thank you, Doctor. Oh, it's almost a relief to know the truth at last.
What do you think, Holmes?
All I can say as yet is that Miss Morstan is to be thanked for presenting us with such an interesting problem.
Now, gentlemen.
Mr. Sholto, I take it that you and your brother searched for the treasure.
Oh, indeed we did. For weeks and months we dug and delved in every part of the garden, but without success. It was maddening to think that the hiding place was on his lips at the very moment he died.
So all you had was this chaplet with the pearls on it?
Yes. And over that, my brother Bartholomew and I had some little discussion. The pearls were obviously of great value. And between ourselves, my brother was himself a little inclined to my father's fault.
He wanted to keep them?
Yes. He argued that if we gave the chaplet away, it might lead to trouble. All I could do was to persuade him to let me find Miss Morstan's address and to send her a pearl at fixed intervals, so that at least she need never feel destitute.
That was a very kindly thought, Mr. Sholto.
Oh, my dear lady, we were your trustees. That was the view I took of it.
But your brother didn't see it in that light.
No. No, I'm afraid he didn't. Our difference of opinion on the subject went so far that I thought it best to leave Pondicherry Lodge and set up rooms for myself. And as you see...
Then may I ask why, after all these years, you suddenly decided to get in touch with Miss Morstan today?
Because the treasure has been discovered.
Discovered?
Good. It hasn't.
Yes, indeed. And it only remains for us to drive to Norwood and demand our share.
Does your brother know we're coming?
Oh, yes. I explained my views to him last night. We shall be expected, if not welcome, visitors.
Mr. Sholto, you have done well from first to last.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you.
We may be able to make you some small return by throwing light on things that are still dark to you. Ah, but as Miss Morstan has said, it's getting late, and we'd best put the matter through without delay.
Quite so. I will prepare myself for the journey. I must take care to wrap up carefully. My health is somewhat fragile.
Our new acquaintance coiled up the tube of his hookah and then produced from behind a curtain a very long, befrogged top coat with astrakhan collar and cuffs. This he buttoned tightly up and finished his attire by putting on a rabbit skin cap with hanging lappets that covered his ears, so that no part of him was visible except his peaky and mobile face. Our cab was awaiting us outside, and our driver started off at once at a rapid pace.
You haven't told us how the treasure was discovered, Mr. Sholto.
Ah, Bartholomew was a clever fellow. He'd come to the conclusion that the treasure must be somewhere indoors, so he made measurements all over the house in order that not one inch should be unaccounted for.
Really? Quite a man of method.
Oh, yes. And among other things, he found that the height of the building was 74 feet. But when he added together the heights of all the separate rooms and allowed for the space in between, he couldn't bring the total to more than 70 feet.
Yes, but wait a minute. How could he calculate the space between the floors?
By borings, presumably.
That's right. He made borings.
Oh, yes, I see. Well, sorry to interrupt. Do go on.
There were 4 feet unaccounted for. Well, these could only be at the top of the building. So he knocked a hole through the ceiling of the top floor room, which he used as his study. And there, sure enough, was a little garret which nobody knew about. And in the center of it stood the treasure chest. He lowered it through the hole, and there it lies.
Have you any idea of the worth of the treasure, Mr. Sholto?
My brother computes the value of the jewels at not less than 500,000 sterling.
Good. Half a million?
No.
Don't you realize what that means, Miss Morstan? If we can secure your rights, you will be the richest heiress in England.
I'm sure we congratulate you, Miss Morstan. Don't we, Doctor?
Yes, of course. My sincerest congratulations.
For the rest of that journey, I sat downcast. It was the place of a loyal friend to rejoice at the news, but I'm ashamed to say that selfishness took me by the soul. An heiress. It was time for me to stop chasing will-o'-the-wisps and come back to reality. My heart was heavy as lead. And it was a relief to me when I realized that our journey was at its end.
Here we are, Miss Morstan. This is Pondicherry Lodge. May I give you a hand?
Thank you.
What do you make the time, Watson?
Nearly 11.
Well, at least we've left the city fog behind us.
Williams, hand me one of the side lamps from the carriage.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. As you see, my friends, Pondicherry Lodge stands in its own grounds. This high wall runs right round, and there's broken glass on top of it. The only way in is through this iron door.
Who's there?
It's I, McMurdo. Surely you know my knock by now.
Oh, it seems that you're in here so early.
That you, Mr. Thaddeus?
Can't you see it is?
Who are the others? I had no orders about them from the master.
No, McMurdo. You surprise me. I told my brother last night that I should be bringing some friends.
He's no been out of his room the day, Mr. Thaddeus, and I have no orders.
Now, look here.
I can let you in, but as for your friends, they must just bide where they are.
Oh, this is too bad. Surely, if I guarantee them, that's enough.
Very sorry, Mr. Thaddeus. Folk may be friends of yours and yet no friends of the master's. He pays me well to do my duty, and my duty I'll do.
Listen.
I don't know your friends.
Oh, yes, you do, McMurdo.
Well,
I don't think you could have forgotten me. Don't you remember the amateur who fought three rounds with you at Allison's rooms on the night of your benefit 4 years back?
Not Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
None other.
Ah, certes. Who could have mistaken you? If instead of standing so there so quiet, you'd just stepped up and given me yon cross hit of yours under the jaw, ah, I'd have known you without question. Ah, you're one that has wasted your gifts. You might have aimed high if you'd joined the fancy.
Ah, you see, Watson, if all else fails me, I still have one of the scientific professions open to me. Our friend won't keep us out in the cold now, I'm
then sure. Then ye come, sir, you and your friends. Very sorry, Mr. Thaddeus, but orders are very strict. I had to be certain of your friends before I let them in. Mind the wee step, miss, as you come through the door.
Inside, a gravel path wound through desolate grounds to the house, which was plunged in shadow. Save where a moonbeam struck one corner and glimmered in a garret window. The vast size of the building, with its gloom and its deathly silence, struck a chill to the heart. Even Thaddeus Sholto seemed ill at ease.
I can't understand it. I distinctly told Bartholomew we were coming, and yet there's no light in his window. I don't know what to make of it.
Does he always guard the premises like this?
Yes, he has followed my father's custom. He was the favorite son, you know. I sometimes think my father may have told him more than he ever told me.
Which is his window?
Up there, where the moonshine strikes. But I don't think there's any light inside.
No. But I see a glint of light in that little window beside the door.
Ah, that's the housekeeper's room. That's where old Mrs. Burnstone sits. She'll be able to tell us all about it.
Let's go to her, then.
No, I think it would be better if you waited here for a minute or two. She may not have heard about our coming, and if we all go in together, she might be alarmed. Listen, what's that?
Oh, what is it, Doctor?
It's a woman's voice. She sounds afraid.
It must be Mrs. Burnstone. She's the only woman in the house. Wait here. I'll be back in a moment.
I'm so glad you've come. I've been worried out of my mind.
What's the matter?
Oh, please come in, sir. I can't tell you how glad I am to see you. Oh, come in.
Our guide had left us the lantern. Holmes swung it slowly round, peering at the house and the great rubbish heaps which cumbered the grounds. Miss Morstan and I stood together, and her hand was in mine. We had never seen each other before that day, yet now our hands instinctively sought for each other. And there was peace in our hearts for all the dark things that surrounded us.
What a strange place.
It is indeed. It looks as though all the moles in England had been let loose in the grounds. I've seen something of the sort on the site of a hill near Ballarat, where the prospectors had been at work.
And for the same reason, my dear Watson, these are the traces of the treasure seekers.
Of course, they were 6 years looking for it.
Exactly. No wonder the place looks like a gravel pit.
Mr. Holmes.
What's the matter, ma'am?
There's something amiss. I'm frightened. My nerves can't stand it.
Pull yourself together and tell us what's happened.
Mrs. Burnstone says Bartholomew has locked himself in his room and won't answer her. She's been waiting to hear from him all day.
Hasn't she been up to it?
Yes. She went up an hour ago and looked through the keyhole.
Well?
She won't tell me what she saw. She says I must go and look for myself. Won't you please come with me? I simply don't feel equal to going up there alone. Whatever she saw, it must be terrible.
Come into the house at once. Miss Morstan, it might be better if you stayed with Mrs. Burnstone.
Yes,
Mr. You might be able to comfort the poor lady. Come, Watson.
Sherlock Holmes took the lamp and led the way. Leaving Miss Morstan with the frightened housekeeper, we went up the stairs. Twice as we ascended, Holmes whipped his lens out of his pocket and carefully examined what appeared to me to be merely shapeless smudges of dust on the coconut matting that served as a stair carpet. The third flight of stairs ended in a long, straight passage, with a great picture in Indian tapestry on the right of it, and three doors on the left. At the third door, we stopped.
This is my brother's study.
Very well, then.
You see? There's something amiss. I know there is.
Quiet, please.
Locked, as the housekeeper said.
And bolted too, I fancy.
Mrs. Burnstone said she could see through the keyhole.
But if it's locked...
The key must have been turned far enough to leave a gap. Let's have a look. Watson, there's something devilish in this. Look for yourself and see what you make of it.
Yeah. Merciful heavens.
What have you seen? What have you seen?
It's the same face. Your face.
Well, of course, he's my twin, I told you. But what has happened?
What is it, Holmes? That horrible smile, that fixed, unnatural grin. Is it a trick of the moonlight?
I fancy not.
Holmes, this is terrible. What's to be done?
The door must come down. Come on, Watson, help me. We've got to get in there.
Right.
As I thought, he's been dead for hours.
Sitting there, twisted and smiling. Holmes.
Hmm?
His muscles are as stiff as a board. This isn't just ordinary rigor mortis. It's something more.
Ah, a weapon on the table here. A stick with a stone head lashed to it like a hammer, and there's a piece of paper with something written. Hold the lantern close. Read it, Watson.
The sign of the four. In God's name, what does it all mean?
It means murder. Ah, I expected this. See, there, in the skin just above his ear.
It looks like a long, dark thorn.
It is a thorn. You can pick it out, but be careful. It's poisoned.
Well, it comes away easily enough. Look, there's only the tiniest speck of blood.
Even so, it's done its work.
Holmes, this is fantastic. The thing grows darker instead of clear.
On the contrary, it clears every instant.
Mr. Holmes, The treasure. It's gone.
What?
Gone? They've robbed him of the treasure.
You're sure it was here?
There, in the ceiling, is the hole through which we lowered it. I helped him do it myself. I left him with it last night, and I heard him lock the doors. I came downstairs. I was positively the last person here. Oh. Oh, you don't think I did it, do you? I didn't. I swear I didn't.
Mr. Sholto, you were not the last person here.
How can you say that?
Look there on the floor by the table.
Huh?
Do you see it? A small circular disc of mud?
Well, what does that tell us? That's not a footmark.
No, but it's something much more valuable to us. The impression of a wooden stump.
You think?
I think, Mr. Sholto, he's been here again.
He?
Who? The wooden-legged man.
In the second episode of The Sign of Four by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the part of Sherlock Holmes was played by Richard Herndl, Dr. Watson by Brian Coleman, Mary Morstan by Barbara Mitchell, and Thaddeus Sholto by John Moffat. The story is adapted for broadcasting by Felix Felton and produced by Archie Campbell for the BBC. The BBC presents The Sign of Four, a Sherlock Holmes story by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, adapted for radio in 5 episodes by Felix Felton. The story is told by Sherlock Holmes' friend and assistant, Dr. Watson. Episode 3, The Trail of the Wooden-Legged Man.
Good day to you. At his house in South London, Mr. Thaddeus Sholto told us of his father's terror of wooden-legged men, and how, on his deathbed, the father had confessed to withholding from Miss Mary Morstan her rightful share of the great Agra treasure. Startled by seeing a wild-looking man peering through the window, he had died without revealing the whereabouts of the treasure. But now, said Mr. Sholto, it had been found by his twin brother, Bartholomew, in a secret attic of his home. We went with Mr. Sholto to his brother's house and found the brother sitting dead and twisted in a chair.
a small thorn was sticking in his head just behind the ear. And by his side was a note which read, "The Sign of the Four." We were still examining the dead man when we heard a wail from Mr. Thaddeus Sholto.
Oh, Mr. Holmes, the treasure, it's gone.
Gone? Are you certain?
Of course I am. We lowered it down together, and I was the last person here. You don't think I did it, do you? I swear I didn't.
Calm yourself, Mr. Sholto. You were not the last person here. Look there on the floor by the table. Huh? Do you see it? A small circular disc of mud.
Well, what does that tell us? It's not a footmark.
No, but it's something much more valuable to us. The impression of a wooden stump.
You mean...
I mean, Mr. Sholto, the wooden-legged man has been here. Look, there it is again, and there by the window.
But how could he get into this room? I mean, the door was locked, and we're three floors up.
That we have to discover. Your first duty, Mr. Sholto, is to drive down to the station and report the matter to the police.
Oh, I can't do that. They'll suspect me. They'll think I had a hand.
You have nothing to fear. Go to the police and offer to assist them in every way. But please, Mr. Sholto, you owe it to your brother. Dr. Watson and I will wait here until you return.
Oh, very well, if you say so. Oh, merciful heavens, what a terrible business. I shall never survive it.
Now, Watson, we have half an hour to ourselves. Let us make good use of it. My case is almost complete.
Almost complete?
Yes, but we mustn't err on the side of overconfidence. Simple as it seems, there may be something deeper underlying it.
I'm glad you find it simple. I don't.
Just sit in the corner there so that your footprints don't complicate matters.
Huh? Oh, yeah.
Now to work. How did Timbertoe get in here? The door was locked, that we know. The window? Oh, it's snipped on the inner side. Framework solid. No hinges at the side. Let's open it. No water pipe near. Roof quite out of reach. Ah, come and look, Watson. There's the print of a foot in mold on the sill. It did rain a bit, you remember?
Yeah, and there's another of those muddy circles.
Quite so. But there was someone else, a very able and efficient ally.
Oh, I don't...
Look down, Doctor, below you. Could you scale that wall?
My hat, no. It must be 60 feet from the ground, and I can't see a foothold or even a crevice in it anywhere. Oh, no, it's impossible.
Without help, yes, but suppose you had a friend up here who lured you that good stout rope I see in the corner, fastening one end to this great hook in the wall. You could swarm up then, wooden leg and all.
And I suppose he left the same way. And then whoever it was up here drew up the rope and shut the window.
That's it. As a minor point, we may note that our wooden-legged friend was not a professional sailor.
Why not?
His hands were far from being horny. There's more than one blood mark on this rope. He must have slipped down so fast that he took the skin off his palm.
That's all very well, but what about this mysterious friend? How did he get in? Or out, for that matter?
The friend. Yes. He's rather interesting. He lifts the case from the regions of the commonplace, though parallel cases suggest themselves from India.
Possibly, but how did he get in? The door's locked, the window's inaccessible. Did he come down the chimney?
No, the grate's too small, I thought of that.
Well, how then?
Oh, Watson, you will not apply my precepts.
What precept?
How often have I told you that when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. He didn't come by the door, the window, or the chimney, so...
Well... He must have come through the hole in the ceiling.
That's it. He came via the secret attic in which the treasure was found. We'd better get up there and see what we can find.
Holmes mounted a chair and, seizing a rafter in either hand, swung himself with incredible agility up into the garret. Then, lying on his face, he reached down for the lamp and held it while I followed him as best I could. The garret was about 10 feet one way and 6 the other. The roof ran up to an apex and was evidently the inner shell of the true roof of the house. There was no furniture of any sort, and the accumulated dust of years lay on the floor.
Careful where you tread. It's only thin plaster between the rafters.
Yeah.
Ah, here you are, you see. There's a trap door in the sloping wall that must lead out onto the roof. From there, no doubt, our agile friend would find easy access to the ground. Yes, the trap opens quite easily. That's how number one entered. Let's see if we can find any other traces of him. Oh, yes, there we are. Splendid footprint. See? The perfect impression of a naked foot.
But Holmes, it's so small.
Can it be that a child has done this awful thing?
No, not a child. I was staggered myself for a moment, but the thing's quite natural. My memory failed me, or I should have been able to foretell it.
What does it mean?
Oh, then? My dear Watson, try a little analysis yourself. You know my methods. Apply them.
I can't think of anything that would cover the facts.
Well, it'll be clear to you soon enough. There's nothing more to be learned here, as far as I can see. But I'll take a closer look.
Holmes moved about the room with his lens and a tape measure, comparing and examining. His long, thin nose only a few inches from the floor. His movements were swift, silent and furtive, like those of a bloodhound picking out a scent. And I couldn't help thinking what a terrible criminal he would have made had he turned his energies against the law instead of in its defense. Finally, he gave a little crow of delight and swung himself down into the room below.
Ah!
Whither I followed him.
We're certainly in luck, Watson. We ought to have very little trouble now.
Why? What have you found?
You see that table with the Bunsen burners and retorts? Evidently our friend Bartholomew was a bit of a chemist. Down beside it, there are some carboys of acid in wicker baskets, and one of them's either leaking or got broken.
Yeah. You can smell it in the air.
Creosote. And number one had the misfortune to tread in it with his bare foot. There were traces of it upstairs.
How does that help us?
Why, we've got him, that's all. I know a dog that would follow that scent to the world's end. If a pack can track a trailed herring across a shire, how far can a specially trained animal follow a smell like this? It sounds like a sum in the rule of three, and the answer should give us the view halloo. Ah, here are the representatives of the law. Before they come, just look at this poor fellow in the chair again. Feel his muscles.
Hard as a board.
Quite so. In a state of extreme contraction. Then there's the distortion of the face, this Hippocratic smile, or risus sardonicus, as the old writers called it. What conclusion would you come to?
Death from some powerful vegetable alkaloid. Some substance like strychnine, which would produce tetanus.
Exactly. Now, look at this form that we found in his head. Careful with it.
There's some gummy stuff on the end.
Is it an English thorn?
No, it certainly isn't.
Well, there you are, then. Ah, but here are the regulars.
There you are, Inspector.
Well, here's a pretty business. Who are all these people? The house seems as full as a rabbit warren.
I think you must remember me, Mr. Athelney Jones.
Why, of course I do. It's Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the theorist. Remember you. I'll never forget how you lectured us all on causes and effects in the Bishopsgate jewel case.
I set you on the right track.
More by good luck than good guidance.
It was a piece of very simple reasoning.
Oh, come now, come. Never be ashamed to own up. Well, now, what's all this, sir? Oh, dear. Oh, bad business. How lucky I happened to be out at Norwood over another case. I was at the station when the message arrived. Now, what do you think the man died of?
It's not for me to theorize.
Well, we can't deny you hit the nail on the head sometimes.
Thank you.
I understand the door was locked. Jewels worth $500,000 missing. How was the window?
Fastened, but there are footprints on the sill.
Well, if it was fastened, the footprints can't be anything to do with it. That's common sense. Man might have died in a fit, but then the jewels are missing. Oh, I have it. Well, just step outside, Sergeant, and you, Mr. Sholto.
Oh, but I would much rather...
Outside, if you don't mind. Now, Mr. Holmes, what do you think of this? Sholto confesses that he was with his brother last night. The brother died in a fit, and Sholto walked off with the treasure. How's that?
On which the dead man very considerately got up and locked the door on the inside.
Yes. There's a flaw there. But there was a quarrel, that we know. And no one saw the brother from the time Thaddeus left him. His bed hasn't been slept in. Thaddeus is evidently in a most disturbed state of mind. You see, I am weaving my web around Thaddeus.
You're not in possession of the facts yet. This splinter of wood was in the man's head. I think it's poisoned.
Oh.
There's also this paper, inscribed as you see it, in this curious stone-headed instrument. How does all that fit into your theory?
Confirms it in every respect.
Indeed?
Yes, The house is full of Indian curiosities. If that splinter is poisoned, Thaddeus can have used it just as well as anyone else.
What about the bit of paper?
Oh, that's just some hocus-pocus of blind, I expect. The only question is, how did he get away? That hole in the ceiling, I imagine.
There's a trap door up there leading to the roof.
Well, there you are, then. Sergeant?
Yes, sir?
Ask Mr. Sholto to step this way.
You're wanted, Mr. Sholto.
Well, what have you discovered?
Mr. Sholto, it is my duty to inform you that anything you say will be taken down and used in evidence against you.
I beg your pardon?
I arrest you in the Queen's name as being concerned in the death of your brother.
Mr. Holmes, didn't I tell you?
Don't trouble yourself, Mr. Sholto. I think I can engage to clear you of the charge.
Don't promise too much, Mr. Theorist.
I'll do more, Mr. Jones. I'll make you a free present of the name and description of one of the two people who were in this room last night.
The two people?
His name, I've every reason to believe, is Jonathan Small. He's poorly educated, small, active, and wears a wooden stump on his right leg, which is worn away on the inner side.
Oh, my dear.
His
Mr.
left boot
Holmes,
has a coarse, square-toed sole with a band round the heel. He's a middle-aged man, sunburnt, and has been a convict, and there's a good deal of skin missing from the palm of his hand.
And what about the other one?
Ah, he is rather a curious person. I hope before very long to introduce you to the pair of them. And now, you'll excuse me, Watson, a word with you.
Leaving Jones and Sholto open-mouthed, Holmes led me from the room onto the landing. We stopped at the head of the stairs, out of earshot of the others.
Watson, we mustn't forget about Miss Morstan. She's been with the housekeeper all this time.
I was thinking of that. She oughtn't to stay in this house.
Take her home, then. She lives with Mrs. Cecil Forrester in Lower Camberwell. It's not very far. Unless you're too tired?
Rather not.
Good man. You can take the cab the police came in.
What about you? Will you wait here?
Yes, there are several things to do. Now, when you drop Miss Morstan off, go to number 3 Pinchin Lane.
Pinchin Lane? Where's that?
On the riverside at Lambeth. The third house on the right-hand side is a bird stuffer's. Sherman is the name.
Sherman?
Knock the old man up and tell him with my compliments I want Toby at once.
Toby?
Yes, a queer mongrel, half spaniel, half lurcher. He has the most amazing power of scent. I would rather have Toby's help than the whole detective force of London.
Well, how's the time?
1 o'clock.
So late? Well, I ought to be back by 3 if the horse is fairly fresh.
Off you go, then. I'll see what I can learn from the old housekeeper and the Indian servant. And then I shall study the methods of the great Jones.
Away at last from that stricken house, Miss Morstan burst into a passion of weeping. She has told me since that she thought me cold and distant on that journey. She little knew the struggle within me. She was weak and helpless. And yet, if the treasure was found, she would be an heiress. Was it fair? Was it honorable that a half-pay surgeon should take advantage of an intimacy brought about by chance? The Agra treasure loomed like an impassable barrier between us.
It's the big house on the right.
The house on the right, driver.
Yes, sir.
Have you your key? The servant must have gone to bed hours ago.
Mrs. Forrester said she would wait up for me.
Oh, but it's 2 o'clock. Oh, yes, yes, there is a light still burning.
Dr. Watson, there's no need to disbelieve me. I may be only a paid governess here, but Mrs. Forrester has always treated me as an honored friend.
Oh, my dear lady, please don't misunderstand me. I'm only thinking of your safety.
Hey, Major White, sir.
What? Oh, yes, yes, I'll only be a moment.
Don't let me delay you, Doctor.
Miss Morstan, please allow me at least to meet this lady and explain what has...
Oh, my child. Are you safe and sound? Yes, Mrs. Forrester. Oh. May I introduce Dr. Watson, who has escorted me home?
Oh, how do you do?
How do you do?
Dr. Watson is a friend of Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Thank you, Doctor. It was I who sent her to Mr. Holmes.
So I understand.
I knew she would be in good hands. But the whole affair is so mysterious. Oh, pray come in, Doctor, and tell me what has occurred.
No, please, you must forgive me. I have an urgent errand for Mr. Holmes. Oh. Besides, Miss Morstan is tired. She should rest at once.
Shall we hear from you then, Dr. Watson?
Of course, just as soon as there is any news.
Perhaps you will take tea with us this afternoon.
Thank you. Yes, I should like to.
You promise?
Faithfully.
Good night then, Doctor. And thank you for seeing me home.
Good night, Miss Morstan.
Good night, Mrs. Forrester.
Good night, Doctor.
And now to pinch in lane, driver.
Yes, sir.
I stole a glance back at the two figures on the doorstep. It was a soothing glimpse of a tranquil English home in the midst of the wild, dark business that absorbed us. And then we were off again through the silent, gaslit streets. Pinchin Lane proved to be a row of shabby two-storied brick houses in the lower quarter of Lambeth. Number 3, like the rest of the street, was all in darkness.
Get away, you drunken vagabond! If you kick up any more air, I'll open the kennels and let 43 dogs out on you!
Just let one out! That's what I've come for!
Will you get away? I've a whammer in this bed, and I'll drop it on your head if you don't look it!
I tell you, I've come to fetch a dog!
Don't argue! 1, 2, 3, and down he comes!
Will you please listen?
1, 2...
I'm from Mr. Sherlock Holmes!
Mr. Sherlock Holmes? Why don't you say so? Half a minute!
Step in, sir! Friend of Mr. Sherlock is always welcome. Step clear of the badger, sir. He bites.
Oh.
Ah, naughty, naughty. Would you take the nip of the gentleman?
Sick.
Ah, don't worry, sir. It's only a slow worm. It ain't got no fangs and it keeps the beetles down, so it gives it the run of the room.
I see.
You mustn't mind my being a little short with you, Bursa. There's many a one comes down this lane just to knock me up for the devil of it. Now, what was it Mr. Sherlock Holmes wanted, sir?
He wanted a dog of yours called Toby.
Oh, yes. Toby lives at number 7 on the left here. Mind your head, sir.
No, what, sir?
There's fowls in them rafters. This is Toby. All right, Toby, quiet, sir.
How on earth am I going to make friends with him?
Here, give him this lump of sugar. That'll win him over.
Toby. Toby, good dog. Good, good Toby. The lump of sugar sealed the alliance, and Toby followed me into the cab without making any difficulties. It had just struck 3 when I found myself once more at Pondicherry Lodge. Holmes was standing on the doorstep with his hands in his pockets, smoking his pipe.
Ah, you have him. Good dog, then. Well, we've had an immense display of energy since you left. Athelney Jones has arrested friend Thaddeus, the gatekeeper, the housekeeper, and the Indian servant.
Has he indeed?
We've the place to ourselves, except for a constable upstairs. I've been amusing myself by a little roof climbing. Timoteau's friend left an admirable trail of creosote and broken tiles. He came down onto that water barrel. So did I.
Oh! You might have broken your neck.
I reckoned if he could do it, I could. I'm glad I did. He was in such a hurry that he dropped this little case. Careful with it.
Oh. More of those thorns like the one in poor Bartholomew Sholto's head.
Yes. Careful, they're hellish things. But I'm delighted to have them. The chances are they're all he has.
So there's less fear of finding one in your skin. Or mine.
Exactly. I'd sooner face a martini bullet myself. Now, Watson, are you game for a 6-mile trudge?
Why, certainly.
You're sure your leg will stand it?
Oh, yes.
Stand it. Then we'll see what Toby makes of this handkerchief. I dipped it in the creosote when I was upstairs. Here you are, old boy. Good old Toby. Smell it, Toby. Smell it.
What a comical beast. Look at the cock of his head. He might be sniffing the bouquet of some famous vintage.
All right, that's enough for him. Now, give me his chain. We'll see what happens. Come on, Toby.
Holmes led Toby over to the water barrel. Immediately the dog's nose was on the ground and his tail in the air, and he pattered off on the trail, straining at his leash. He led us across the grounds to a corner screened by a beech tree, where two walls joined.
Ah, you see, Watson? There are several loose bricks here. The place has been used as a ladder. And look, there's the print of Timber Toe's hand.
And a fleck of blood.
Yes. He tore his hand on the rope, you remember? How lucky we are there have been no heavy rains since yesterday. The scent will still lie on the road.
But they've had 28 hours start. Think of all the traffic there must have been.
Ah, that won't worry, Toby. Over we go. I'll climb first, and then you can hand me the dog up.
My fears were soon appeased. Once in the road, Toby never hesitated or swerved, but waddled on in his peculiar rolling fashion. Well, clearly the pungent smell of the creosote rose high above all the other contending scents. As the dawn approached, he guided us on through the half-rural, villa-lined roads that lead to the metropolis. Holmes, I still don't see how you know so much about this wooden-legged man, whom you say is Jonathan Small.
Oh, my dear boy, simplicity itself. Consider, two officers in command of a convict guard learn an important secret about some buried treasure. A map is drawn for them by an Englishman named Jonathan Small. You remember we saw the name from the chart in Captain Morstan's possession.
Yes.
The officers or one of them secures the treasure and brings it to England, leaving, we'll suppose, some condition under which he received it unfulfilled. Now then, why didn't Jonathan Small get the treasure himself?
I've no idea.
Well, it's obvious. Because he and the three associates named on the chart were convicts and couldn't get away.
But that's mere speculation.
Next, that letter that Major Sholto received from India, the one that gave him such a great fright. What did it tell him?
That the men he'd wronged had been set free.
More likely that they'd escaped, hence the shock. And what does he do then? He guards himself against a wooden-legged man, a white one. He fired at a white tradesman, you remember?
Yes, indeed.
There is only one white man's name on the chart. The other three are Hindus or Mohammedans. Therefore, the wooden-legged man must be Jonathan Small. All right so far?
Yes, yes, that's quite clear.
Good. Oh, how's your leg holding out, Watson?
Oh, perfectly well, thank you. Do we know any more about this mysterious other man?
Well, I can tell you one thing. His footprint is unlike yours or mine. It shows each of his toes distinctly divided. Ours would be all cramped together.
But what does that...
Well, just bear it in mind. Ah, the morning air. Look at that one little cloud. It's like a pink feather from some gigantic flamingo.
We traversed Streatham, Brixton, and Camberwell. By now, labourers and dockmen were astir. Slatternly women were taking down shutters and brushing doorsteps. Rough-looking men were emerging from public houses, rubbing their sleeves across their beards after their morning wet. We were borne away through the side streets to the east of the Oval, until suddenly, at a corner, the dog Toby halted, with one ear cocked and the other drooping, the very picture of canine indecision.
What the deuce is the matter with the dog?
Surely they didn't go off in a cab.
Or in a balloon?
Oh, well, perhaps they stood here for some time.
So the dog does the same.
Rope!
Oh, all right. We're off again.
My hat! The scent must be strong. He's not even putting his nose to the ground.
I think we're near the end of our journey, Watson. Look how he's tugging at the leash. He's trying to run. I'll go ahead with him, Watson. You follow on as quickly as you can manage.
In the distance, I saw Holmes and Toby turn off into a large timber yard. When I arrived, Toby was sitting triumphantly on top of a large barrel on a hand trolley. The staves of the barrel and the wheels of the trolley were smeared with a dark liquid, and the whole air was heavy with the smell of creosote. So Toby's not infallible.
Well, he acted according to his lights. If you consider how much creosote is carted about London in one day, it's not surprising our trail was crossed.
Well, we'd better try and get on the main scent again.
Yes, it must have been at that corner where he hesitated. There were two trails, obviously, and he took the wrong one. Let's go back and try our luck.
Rope.
Come, Toby.
Rope.
Good dog.
Back at the corner, Toby cast about in a wide circle, and then dashed off towards the riverside. He took us down to a landing stage on the water's edge. Close to it was a small brick house with a wooden placard in the window. Mordecai Smith, boats to hire by the hour or day. Steam launch available. As we approached, the door of the house opened. and a little curly-haired boy came running out, followed by a stoutish red-faced woman with a large sponge in her hand.
Jack, you young man, come back and be washed. You want your father to come out and see you like that?
Oh. Oh, what a dear little chap. Is there anything you'd like, Jack?
I'd like a shilling.
Nothing you'd like better?
2 shillings.
Here you are, then. A fine child, Mrs. Smith.
Lord bless you, sir, he is that. And forward. Gets more most too much for me to manage when my man's away.
Oh, away, is he? Oh, that's a pity. I wanted to hire his steam launch.
Why, sir, it's a steam launch he's gone in. That's what puzzles me. I know there ain't more coals in her that would take a village and back.
Well, he might have bought some at a wharf down the river.
Oh, he might, sir, but it weren't his way. Many a time I've heard him call out at their prices. Besides, I don't like that wooden-legged man. What's he always knocking about here for?
Wooden-legged man?
Yes, sir. Brown, monkey-faced chap. My man knew he was coming because he had steam up in the launch.
Was this wooden-legged man alone?
Couldn't say, sir. He tapped on the window at 3 a.m. and my old man woke up Jim, that's my oldest, and off they went. All I heard was his wooden leg clacking on the stones.
Oh, dear, what a pity. I wanted a steam launch myself, and I've heard such good reports of the
Aurora, sir.
Ah, yes, of course. She's not that old green launch with the yellow line. Is she very broad in the beam?
Not her. She's as trim a little thing as any on the river. She's been fresh painted. Black with 2 red lines.
2 red lines. Thank you. I'm going down the river, and if I see the Aurora, I'll tell Mr. Smith you're uneasy. Black funnel, you say?
No, sir, white, with a black band.
Ah, of course. It was the sides which were black. Good morning, Mrs. Smith.
Good morning, sir.
Ah, there's a boatman there with a wherry, Watson. Let's take it and cross the river. The main thing with people like Mrs. Smith, Watson, is never to let them think their information is of the slightest use to you. Otherwise, they shut up like an oyster.
Very neat. Well, our course seems clear enough now.
What would you do?
Engage a launch and go looking for the Aurora.
Oh, my dear fellow, that would take you days. The river's a perfect labyrinth of landing places for miles.
Bring in the police, then?
No, thank you. I have the fancy for working it out myself now that we've got so far.
What are we to do, then?
Take a hansom, drive home and have some breakfast and an hour's sleep. And on the way, we'll stop at the Great Peter Street Post Office. You remember the Jefferson Hope case?
Indeed, I do.
Then you remember the special detective force we recruited from all the little street Arabs in the neighborhood of Baker Street?
You mean you're going to use them again?
That's it. I'll send a wire to Master Wiggins, their leader. If the launch is above water, they'll find her. They'll go everywhere, see everything, overhear everyone. Jonathan Small doesn't know it yet. But in a couple of hours, he'll be up against the Baker Street Irregulars.
That was the third episode of The Sign of Four by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, adapted for radio by Felix Felton. With Richard Herndl as Sherlock Holmes, and Brian Coleman as Dr. Watson. Production is by Archie Campbell for the BBC. The BBC presents The Sign of Four, a Sherlock Holmes story by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, adapted for radio in 5 episodes by Felix Felton. The story is told by Sherlock Holmes' friend and assistant, Dr. Watson. Episode 4, The Quest and the Kill.
Good day to you. It was between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning when Holmes and I returned from our night-long search for the wooden-legged man and his unknown companion. Guided by the mongrel dog Toby, we had followed the trail as far as the edge of the river, and there had learned that he had hired a steam launch from a Mr. Mordecai Smith and escaped us onto the crowded Thames. I was limp and weary after the successive excitements of the night. But a bath at Baker Street and a complete change soon improved matters. When I came down to our room, I found the breakfast laid and Holmes deep in a morning newspaper.
Ah, there you are, Doctor. How are you feeling?
Not too bad, thank you. Anything in the paper?
Everything. The energetic Jones and the ubiquitous reporter have fixed it up between them. It's really rather rich.
Jones hasn't minimized his own contribution, I take it.
Far from it. Help yourself to the ham and eggs. I'll read you some of the finer passages.
Thank you.
Here we are. Mysterious business at Upper Norwood. About 12 o'clock last night, Mr. Bartholomew Sholto of Pondicherry Lodge, Upper Norwood, was found dead in his room under circumstances which point to foul play. As far as we can learn, no traces of violence were found upon Mr. Sholto's person, but a valuable collection of Indian gems inherited from his father has been carried off. The discovery was first made by Mr. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson.
Oh, we do get a mention then.
Just, but listen to this. By a singular piece of good fortune, Mr. Athelney Jones, a well-known member of the detective police force, was at the Norwood police station at the time and was able to apply his trained and experienced faculties to the case within half an hour of the first alarm.
Oh, really?
And then he goes on to describe his arrest of the housekeeper, the gatekeeper, and the Indian servant.
I still marvel that he didn't arrest us as well.
So do I. He still may if he gets another of those attacks of energy. Now, where was I? Mr. Jones' well-known technical knowledge and his powers of minute observation have enabled him to prove conclusively that the miscreants must have entered through a trap door in the roof.
Well, I'll be...
The prompt and energetic action of the officers of the law shows the great advantage of the presence on such occasions of a single, vigorous and masterful mind.
Holmes, you're positively putting me off my breakfast.
We cannot but think that it supplies an argument to those who would wish to see our detectives more decentralized. Hello, who's this? Ah, splendid. Master Wiggins has received my telegram. Just outside our front door, Watson, there are at least a dozen ragged little street Arabs. The Baker Street irregulars are on parade.
What do you want? You can't go upstairs.
Mr. Ramsey expecting me.
Sent me telegram.
All right, only you then. You're better left to wait down here.
And there's their leader running the gauntlet of Mrs. Hudson.
Yes, I'm afraid she's met her match. Come in. Ah, Wiggins.
Got your message, sir. Brought mine sharp.
Well done.
They're outside, Gov. The old woman wouldn't let them come up.
Never mind. You can pass on my instructions to your friends. Better than having the house invaded. What's the bill so far?
Three bob and a tanner for tickets.
Ah, here you are, then.
Thank you, sir.
Now then, listen carefully.
Yes, sir?
I want you to find the whereabouts of a steamship called the Aurora. Owner, Mordecai Smith.
The Aurora? What's she like, sir?
Black with two red lines. Funnel white with a black band. She's down the river somewhere. I want one boy to be at Mordecai Smith's landing stage to say if the boat comes back.
Yes, sir.
Divide it out among yourselves and do both banks thoroughly and let me know the moment you have news. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
The old scale of pay and a guinea to the boy who finds the boat. Here's a day in advance.
Thank you, sir.
Now, off you go.
Thank you, Gov. We'll find it for you.
Good luck.
Thank you, sir.
That should do it, Watson. I'll wager we hear they've spotted her before evening. There they go. Hell for leather. They'll worm their way in everywhere without attracting the least attention.
What do we do while they're searching?
Wait. There's nothing else we can do. We can't pick up the broken trail until we find either the Aurora or Mordecai Smith.
Well, Toby could eat these scraps, I dare say. Well, are you going to bed, Holmes?
No, I'm not tired. I have a curious constitution. I never remember feeling tired by work, but idleness exhausts me completely. I'm going to smoke and think over this queer business to which our fair client has introduced us. If ever man had an easy task, this should be it. Wooden-legged men are not so common, but the other man should be quite unique.
Ah, that other man again.
I don't want to make a mystery of him, Watson, but you must have formed your own opinion.
I can't say I have.
Consider the data. Diminutive footmarks, naked feet, toes never fettered by boots, great agility. Stone-headed wooden mace, poison darts. What do you make of it?
Must be a savage. Perhaps one of those Indians that Jonathan Small was in league with.
Hardly that. No one in the Indian Peninsula could have left footmarks like that. The Hindu proper has long, thin feet. The Mohammedan wears sandals, which means that the great toe is well separated from the others because of the thong that passes in between. And what about these darts? They could only be shot in one way.
From a blowpipe.
Exactly. So where are we to find our savage?
I don't know. South America.
Hand me the first volume of the Gazetteer.
Here you are.
Thank you. Now, what have we here? Andaman Islands. Situated 340 miles to the north of Sumatra, in the Bay of Bengal.
That's where Sholto was stationed.
Exactly. Now, what can we learn about them? Ah, here we are. The aborigines of the Andaman Islands may perhaps claim the distinction of being the smallest race on Earth. The average height is rather below 4 feet. They are fierce and intractable, but capable of forming devoted friendships. You see, Watson?
I do indeed.
Ah, now then, listen to this. They are naturally hideous, having large, misshapen heads and distorted features, but their hands and feet are remarkably small.
That fits all right.
So does this. They have always been a terror to shipwrecked crews, braining the survivors with their stone-headed clubs or shooting them with their poisoned arrows.
Mm, nice, amiable people.
You're right. If this fellow had been left to his own devices, the affair might have taken an even more ghastly turn.
But how on earth did Jonathan Small come to have such a singular companion?
Ah, that's more than I can tell. No doubt we shall know all about it in time. Look here, Watson, you still look as if you could do with a rest. Lie down there on the sofa and see if I can put you to sleep.
As I stretched myself out, Holmes took his violin from the corner and began to play some low, dreamy, melodious air. I have a vague remembrance of his gaunt limbs, his earnest face, and the rise and fall of his bow. And then I seem to float peacefully away on a sea of sound, with the sweet face of Mary Morstan looking down at me. It was late afternoon when I awoke. Holmes sat exactly as I had left him, except that he had laid aside his violin and was deep in a book. I noticed that his face was dark and troubled.
How do you feel?
Oh, much better, thank you.
You slept soundly. I feared our talk would disturb you.
I didn't hear a thing. You've had fresh news, then?
Unfortunately, no. I must confess I'm very disappointed. I expected something definite by this time. The boy Wiggins has been up. He says no trace can be found of the lounge anywhere. It's a most provoking check. Every hour is of importance.
Can I do anything? I'm feeling perfectly fresh now.
No, we can only wait. If we go ourselves, the message might come in our absence. You do what you like, but I must remain on guard.
Then I'll run over to Camberwell and call on Mrs. Cecil Forrester.
Hmm?
I was asked to this morning.
On Mrs. Forrester?
Well, of course on Miss Morstan, too. She was anxious to hear what happened.
I shouldn't tell them too much. Women are never to be entirely trusted, even the best of them.
Holmes, what an atrocious sentiment. Very well, I'll be discreet. I should be back in an hour or two.
All right. Good luck. But I say...
Yes?
If you're crossing the water, you may as well return Toby. I don't think we shall have any more use for him now.
I took the mongrel and left him with a half-sovereign at the old naturalist's in Pinchin Lane. Then I went on to Miss Morstan, whom I found weary after her night's adventures, but very eager to hear my news. Mrs. Forrester, too, was full of curiosity. I told them all we had done since the previous night. It was evening before I left Camberwell, and quite dark by the time I reached home. My companion's book and pipe lay by his chair, but he had disappeared. I looked about in the hope of seeing a note, but there wasn't one.
Oh, excuse me, sir. Can I lower the blinds? Oh,
certainly, Mrs. Hudson. I suppose Mr. Holmes has gone out.
Oh, no, sir. He's gone to his room, sir.
Oh?
Do you know, sir, I'm afraid for his health.
Why do you say that?
Well, he's that strange, sir. After he was gone, he kept on walking up and down till he got on my nerves. Then I heard him talking to himself. And every time the doorbell went, he'd come onto the landing and shouted, "What's that, Mrs. Hudson?" Then he slammed off to his room again. Oh, I do hope he's not going to be ill, sir.
I don't think you need be uneasy, Mrs. Hudson. I've seen him like this before. He's got something on his mind.
Well, I hope that's all it is, sir, I'm sure.
From time to time during the long night, I heard the dull sound of Holmes' tread and knew how his spirit was chafing against our inaction. At breakfast time, he appeared looking worn and haggard, with a little fleck of feverish colour on either cheek.
I simply cannot understand it, Watson.
You're knocking yourself up, old man. I heard you marching about in the night.
I couldn't sleep. This infernal problem is consuming me.
I know the men, the launch, everything. The whole river's been searched on either side. I've used every means at my disposal, and yet I can get no news.
Mrs. Smith heard nothing of her husband?
No. I shall come to the conclusion soon that they've scuttled the craft. But why?
Perhaps Mrs. Smith was deceiving us. Perhaps the Aurora is sheer invention.
No, I've made inquiries. There is a launch of that description.
Could it have gone upriver?
I've thought of that, too. There's a search party working up as far as Richmond. If no news comes today, I shall start looking myself.
Oh, but surely we shall hear something. However, no word came from the boy Wiggins or anyone else all that day. I walked over to Camberwell in the evening to report our ill success to the ladies and returned to find Holmes busy with some abstruse chemical analysis, whose smell fairly drove me out of the apartment. I could hear the clinking of his malodorous test tubes till the small hours of the morning. In the early dawn, I woke with a start. Holmes was standing by my bedside, fully dressed.
I'm off down the river, Watson.
Hmm?
It's well, the only thing to do. It's worth trying at all events.
Well, can't I come with you?
No, you'll be much more useful if you stay here. Open all notes and telegrams, and if any news does come, act on your own judgment. Can I rely on you?
Of course. Can I get in touch with you by wire?
I'm afraid not. I don't know where I shall be myself. With any luck, though, I may not be gone very long. Oh, by the way, you may get callers.
Oh?
Yes. I've put an advertisement in this morning's Agony column asking anyone who knows the whereabouts of the Aurora to get in touch with Mrs. Smith of Smith's Wharf or with 221B Baker Street. That makes it look as if it's merely Mrs. Smith showing anxiety for her missing husband.
Mm, that's very ingenious.
Hold the fort, then. I'll have some news of some sort or other before I get back. Au revoir.
I had heard nothing of him by breakfast time. The morning paper carrying his notice also informed me that Mr. Thaddeus Sholto and Mrs. Burnstone had now been released, but that Mr. Athelney Jones of Scotland Yard was prosecuting the case with his usual energy and sagacity, and that further arrests were to be expected. The long day dragged on, until at 3 o'clock in the afternoon there was a loud peal at the bell and voices on the stairs.
Come back?
No, sir, he's been out all day.
Oh, I'll see Dr. Watson then.
Very good, sir.
Come in.
Mr. Athelney Jones to see you, sir.
Ah, come in, Mr. Jones.
Good day, sir. Mr. Sherlock Holmes is out, I understand.
Yes, and I'm afraid I don't know when he'll be back. Well, perhaps you'd care to wait. Take that chair and try one of these cigars.
Oh, thank you. I don't mind if I do.
And whiskey and soda?
Oh, well, half a glass. It's very warm for the time of year, and I've had a good deal to try me. You know my theory about this Norwood case?
I remember you expressed one.
Well, I've been obliged to reconsider it.
Oh?
Yes. I'd got my net nice and tight round Mr. Sholto when Poppy went through a hole in the middle of it.
I saw you'd released him.
Yes, I can't shake his alibi. Someone was with him all the time from the moment he left his brother's room. My professional credit's at stake, sir. I should be very glad of a little assistance.
Well, we can all do with it at times.
I had a wire from Mr. Holmes this morning. He's a wonderful man, is Mr. Holmes.
Well, what did the wire say?
Here it is, sir. Handed in at Poplar at 12 o'clock. Go to Baker Street and wait for me. I'm close on track of Sholto Gang. Come tonight if you want to be in at finish.
Ah, splendid. He's evidently picked up the scent again.
Oh, so he's been at fault too, has he? Well, happens to the best of us. Of course, it may be only a false alarm, but as an officer of the law, I mustn't let any chance slip. Oh, hello, who's this?
I'll have a look. It's an old seaman of sorts. He's seen Holmes' advertisement in the paper, no doubt. He has something to tell us.
What advertisement was that?
About the steam launch, Aurora. We think the men you're after may be aboard it. This fellow may have some news of her.
Let's hope so.
Come in.
Someone for Mr. Holmes.
All right. Come in, my man. Oh, thank you, Mrs. Hudson. Our visitor was an aged man, clad in seafaring garb with an old pea jacket and a red scarf around his chin. His back was bent and he wheezed painfully as he stood leaning heavily on a thick, knotted stick. Bushy eyebrows and long grey side whiskers concealed most of his face, except a pair of keen, dark eyes.
But altogether, he gave the impression of a respectable master mariner who had fallen into years and poverty.
Is Mr. Sherlock Holmes here?
No, but I am acting for him. You can give me any message you have for him.
It was to him I wish to tell it.
I tell you, I am acting for him. Was it about the Aurora?
Yes, I knows where it is. And I know where the men he's after are. I knows all about it. But it was to Mr. Holmes I wish to tell it.
Well, you'll have to wait for him then.
Oh, no. No, I ain't going to lose a whole day to please no one. If Mr. Holmes ain't here, then he can find out for himself. I don't care about the looks of either of you, and that's the truth. I'm going home.
Now, wait a bit, my friend. You're not walking off like that. You'll stay here, like it or not, till our friend returns.
That's a pretty sort of treatment, this. I come here to see a gentleman, and you too.
You'll be none the worse. We'll recompense you for your loss of time.
Oh, then perhaps you'll begin by offering me a cigar.
Oh, sister?
Oh, well, I might.
Well, I hardly thought I'd pass that test.
Why, you rogue. Oh, you'd have made a rare actor, you would. Proper workhouse cough, too, and everything. Oh, but I thought you had a glint in your eye, though.
Well, I've been working in that get-up all day. Too many of the criminal classes know me. I can only go on the warpath under some simple disguise like this. Have you got my wire?
Yes, that's why I'm here.
How's your case going?
It's collapsed. I've had to release Sholto and the housekeeper.
Never mind. I'll give you two people in their place. But you must put yourself under my orders. You're welcome to all the official credit, but you must do as I say. Is that agreed?
Entirely.
Then I shall want a fast police boat, a steam launch, to be at Westminster Stairs at 7 o'clock.
That's easy enough. There's always one around about there. But I can slip across the road and telephone to make sure.
I shall also want two staunch men in case of resistance.
There'll be two or three in the boat. Anything else?
When we secure the men, we shall get the treasure. I think it would be a pleasure to my friend here to take the box round to the young lady to whom half of it rightly belongs. Let her be the first to open it. Eh, Watson?
It would certainly be a great pleasure to me.
Well, that's rather irregular, but still, so's the whole thing, so I suppose we must wait at it. The treasure will have to be handed over afterwards to the authorities until there's been an official investigation.
Oh, certainly. Oh, one other point. I should very much like to have a few details on this matter from Johnson Small myself. I take it you don't mind my having an unofficial interview with him here or elsewhere, as long as he's efficiently guarded.
Well, you're a master of the situation. I've no proof yet that this man exists. But if you catch him, you can interview him.
That's understood, then?
Perfectly. Anything else?
Only that I insist on your dining with us here.
Oh, thank you.
I have oysters and a brace of grouse with something a little choice in white wines. Watson, you have never yet recognized my merits as a housekeeper.
Our meal was a merry one. Holmes appeared to be in a state of nervous exaltation. I've never known him so brilliant. He spoke on medieval pottery, on Stradivarius violins, on the Buddhism of Ceylon, and the warships of the future, as if he had made a special study of each. Then, with a bumper to the success of our expedition, we set out. I, with my old service revolver in my pocket. At Westminster Wharf, the police launch was awaiting us. Jones, Holmes, and I sat in the stern. There was one man at the rudder, one to tend the engines, and two burly police inspectors forward.
Is there anything to mark this as a police boat?
Yes, that green lamp at the side.
Take it off, then.
Take the lamp off, Inspector.
Yes, sir.
Where to, Mr. Holmes?
To the tower. Tell them to stop opposite Jacobson's yard.
Down river, right away.
Very good, sir.
I hope she's fast.
There aren't many launches on the river to beat us.
The one we're after is said to be quite a clipper. Now, Watson, I'll tell you how the land lies. You know how I gave my mind a thorough rest by plunging into a chemical analysis?
I do indeed.
Well, when I had dissolved the hydrocarbon, I came back to the case and thought the whole matter out again. And it seemed to me unlikely that Jonathan Small would aim to get away at once.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, he'd clearly been in London for some time, keeping watch. So he'd have to arrange his affairs before he went.
Oh, I don't know. He might have done it already.
I hardly think so. The finding of the treasure must have come as a complete surprise. And then there's the peculiar-looking companion. He'd scarcely want to be seen around with him in the daylight. And we know from Mrs. Smith that it was getting on for dawn when they hired the boat. So I argued that they may well have reserved the boat for their final escape and gone to ground in their lodgings for a day or two to see what the papers had to say.
Taking the launch with
That's the point. If I was right, the lounge must be hidden somewhere nearby.
Yes, but where? They can't have made it invisible.
I put myself in Small's place. How could he hide the lounge and yet have her ready to hand? I see one way of doing it. By handing her over to some boat builder for some trifling repair. Then she'd be concealed in his shed or yard.
That seems simple enough.
Oh, it's just these simple things that are apt to be overlooked. I acted on the idea and went in my seaman's rig to all the yards down the river. I drew blank at 15, but at the 16th, Jacobson's, there she was.
Well done, Holmes.
Yes, she was handed over to them 2 days ago by a wooden-legged man who said there was something wrong with her rudder.
My dear Holmes, I do apologize for ever...
That wasn't the end of it. Who should appear but Mordecai Smith, the missing owner, rather the worse for liquor. He bellowed out his name and the name of his lounge, and then he said, I want her tonight at 8 o'clock sharp by two gentlemen who won't be kept waiting. We must see that we don't keep them waiting either.
While we were talking, we had been shooting the long series of bridges that span the Thames. Nearing the city, the rising moon silvered the cross on the summit of St. Paul's. As we reached the tower, Holmes pointed to a bristle of masts and rigging on the Surrey side.
That's Jacobson's yard. Cruise gently up and down here under cover of this string of lighters.
What are you about, John? Let's go.
There's my sentry at his post.
Oh, you've placed a man there, have you?
A boy, one of my Baker Street irregulars. There he is at the water's edge. Here, take my night glasses. You can see for yourself.
Oh, thank you.
He will wave a handkerchief when they start. No sign yet?
Why don't we go downstream and lie in wait for them?
No, there's just the chance they might go upstream. We're better where we are. From this point, we can see everything perfectly and hardly be observed ourselves. Those folk yonder, see? How clearly are they visible under the lamplight?
They're coming from work in the yard.
Dirty-looking rascals. But I suppose everyone has some little immortal spark concealed about him. A strange enigma, is man.
Didn't somebody call him a soul concealed in an animal?
Winwood Reed is good on the subject. He remarks that while the individual man is an insoluble puzzle, in the aggregate he becomes a mathematical...
Mr. Holmes! There's a handkerchief!
Yes, it's your boy! I can see him plainly.
And there's the Aurora. Going like the devil, too. Full speed ahead, engineer.
Aye, sir.
Make after the launch for the yellow light. By heaven, I'll never forgive myself if she has the heels of us.
Very fast. I doubt if we should catch her.
We must catch her. Keep it on, stokers. Make her do all she can. Even if we burn the boat, we must have...
With every throb of the engines, we sprang forward like a living thing. We flashed past barges, steamers, and merchant vessels. Voices hailed us out of the darkness. Once a tug, with three barges in tow, blundered in between us.
Where do you think you're going?
Still, we followed close on the Aurora's track.
Pile it on, men. Pile it on. Get every pound of steam you can.
I think we gain a little.
I'm sure of it. We'll be up with her in a very few minutes.
Turn your searchlight on her.
We are gaining.
They're Small, sitting in the stern. They know we're after them now.
What's that dark mass lying beside him like a Newfoundland dog?
Ah, there's the danger. Shoot if it moves.
Look at Small. He's after something. You see what he's doing, Holmes?
Never mind him. Watch that bundle at his feet.
I'll hail them.
Hey, stop there! Stop!
Get the weight from a steer! Go to the devil!
That's him, all right. Look at the wooden stump.
Watch that bundle.
It's a man. A miniature man. The smallest and most savage I have ever seen.
And armed with a blowpipe. We must take no chances. Fire if he raises his head.
It was well that we had so clear a view. Even as we looked, the pygmy plucked out from under the dark blanket in which he was wrapped a short, round piece of wood, like a school ruler, and clapped it to his lips. Our pistols rang out together.
Mr. Holmes, the Aurora. The wooden-legged man's got the rudder. He's steering into the bank.
Let him.
But he'll leap ashore.
Onto the mud with that wooden leg. He's a fool if he does.
By heavens, he's done it. He's trapped. Trapped in the mud.
There you are, Jones. There's your Mr. Jonathan Small. Throw the poor devil a rope and haul him aboard.
Aye, aye, sir.
That was the end of our chase. Jonathan Small was dragged over the side like some evil fish. The two Smiths, father and son, aboard me, herself made fast to our stern. Solid iron chest of Indianmanship's deck. There was no key, but it was of considerable weight when we transferred it carefully to our own little cabin. Then we steamed slowly upstream again, flashing our searchlight on either side of us.
No sign of the islander. Down there, he'll remain that strange visitor to our shores, somewhere in the Thames' dark ooze. An interesting type. I'd like to have seen him at closer quarters.
Personally, I'm glad I didn't. Well, Holmes, another case solved.
Not yet, Watson. Settled, you might say, but not solved. Watson.
Yes, Holmes?
Look there, in the wood of the hatchway. That's where we were standing when the chase was on, do you see?
Another of those murderous darts.
Yes. We were hardly quick enough when we fired. A horrible death passed us very close tonight.
Upon my soul, Holmes, you treat it very lightly.
Well, why not? When death passes you by, you realize that life is worth living. To me, that poison thorn is the stimulant that consumes me with curiosity. Watson, you called this another case solved. You're wrong, you know. We've the treasure and the men, or one of them. But what makes a man do these things? What is the power or the curse behind that ill-omened box? That's what we'll learn when we hear the story of Jonathan Small.
That was The Sign of Four, the fourth of five episodes of a Sherlock Holmes story by Sir Arthur Conan, with Richard Herndl as Holmes and Brian Coleman as Dr. Watson. Radio adaptation by Felix Felton. Production for the BBC by Archie Campbell. The BBC presents The Sign of Four, a Sherlock Holmes story by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, adapted for radio by Felix Felton. The story is told by Sherlock Holmes' friend and assistant, Dr. Watson. The final episode, The Strange Story of Jonathan Small. Good day to you. After our capture of the steam launch Aurora, we cruised slowly upstream. In the cabin was the heavy iron box of the Agra treasure, and opposite the man, Jonathan Small, who had waited so long to gain it. He was a sunburned, reckless-eyed fellow of 50 or thereabouts, and sat with his handcuffed hands on his lap, looking with keen, twinkling eyes at the box, which had been the cause of his ill doings. Holmes lit a cigar.
Well, Jonathan Small, I'm sorry it has come to this.
So am I, sir. But I give you my word on the book, I never raised a hand against Mr. Sholto.
That was the work of your accomplice with his blowpipe.
Yes, sir. I only sent him up to let down the rope. But when he found Mr. Sholto there, that little ill-hound fired one of his cursed darts into him. The truth is, I hoped to find the room empty. I knew the habits of the house pretty well, and I thought Mr. Sholto would be downstairs having his supper.
Oh, that was it. Well, you better have a tot of whiskey. You must be pretty wet after that leap in the river.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Well, Small, you're under the charge of Mr. Athelney Jones of Scotland Yard now, and he's going to bring you up to my rooms.
Why is he doing that, sir?
Because if you make a clean breast of it, I may be of use to you. I think I can prove that the poison acts so quickly that the man was dead before you ever reached the room.
That he was, sir. I climbed in through the window, and there was Mr. Sholto with his head slumped on his shoulder. I'd have half-killed little Tonga for it if he hadn't scrambled off. I gave him a taste of the rope afterwards.
Oh, quite a quite a family party.
Hello, Jones.
I think I'll have a pull at that flask.
By all means.
Oh, I must say, Holmes, you cut it rather fine. It was all we could do to overhaul her.
All's well that ends well. I certainly didn't know that the Aurora was such a clipper.
Smith says that if he'd had another man to help him, we'd never have caught him. He swears he knew nothing about the Norwood business.
Neither he did. I chose his launch because I heard she was one of the fastest on the river. We told him nothing, but we paid him well.
Where was he taking you?
To Gravesend. He was to board the Esmeralda outward bound for the Brazils.
Well, if he has done no wrong, we'll see no wrong comes to him.
We must be approaching Vauxhall Bridge, Jones. You remember your promise?
Oh, yes. We'll land Dr. Watson with the treasure, and he shall take it to Mrs. Forrester's house to show to Miss Mary Morstan.
I'm much obliged.
It's most irregular, but an agreement's an agreement. But, Doctor, you won't mind if I send an inspector along with you, will you? All right?
Not at all. I'll show her the treasure and come straight back to Baker Street.
By the way, my man, where's the key to this box? Well?
At the bottom of the river.
Now, why do you want to cause unnecessary trouble? You'll have to break it open, Doctor.
Very well.
We'll wait for you at your rooms, then. And when we've heard what this man has to say, we'll take him on to the station.
They landed me at Vauxhall and I set off in a cab with my heavy iron box and a bluff genial inspector as my companion. I talked lightly, but in my heart I thought ruefully of the irony of my mission. The treasure I was taking to Mary Morstan would make her one of the richest young ladies in England, and out of reach forever of the poor ex-army doctor who loved her so dearly. A quarter of an hour's drive brought us to the house. She was seated by the open window, and as I entered the room, she sprang to her feet with a bright flush of surprise.
Doctor, I heard a cab drive up. I thought Mrs. Forrester had come back early. I never dreamed it might be you. What news have you brought me?
I've brought you something worth all the news in the world. I've brought you a fortune.
You mean that's the treasure?
Yes, the great Agra treasure. Half of it's yours and half the dear Sholto's. We'll have a couple of 100,000 each, at least. Isn't it wonderful?
I owe it to you.
No, not to me. To Sherlock Holmes. He caught our man at the very last moment, making away with it down the Thames. And then Holmes persuaded the police to let me bring it here so that you could be the first to see it.
It was a kind thought, indeed. What a beautiful box it is. It's Indian work, I suppose.
Yes, a Benares metalwork.
It's so heavy. The box alone must be worth a great deal. Have you the key?
I'm afraid Jonathan Small threw it into the Thames.
Oh.
I shall have to borrow Mrs. Forrester's poker. I ought to be able to force that hasp in the front with it. A pity to spoil it, really. It's such beautiful work. Small's given us no option, though. It's coming, I think. Now, we'll soon see.
It's empty.
Empty? I simply can't believe it.
Well, there we are. The treasure's lost.
Oh, thank God.
Why do you say that?
Because it means that now you are within my reach again. I love you, Mary, as truly as a man ever loved a woman. This treasure, these riches, sealed my lips. Now they are gone. And I can tell you at last how I love you. That is why I said, thank God.
Then I say, thank God, too.
A very patient man was that inspector in the cab. It was a weary time before I rejoined him. And when I showed him the empty box, his face clouded over.
Well, there goes the reward. No money, no pay.
Oh, surely.
Yeah, that's how it is, sir. Tonight's work would have been worth a tenner each to Sam Brown and me if the treasure had been there.
Mr. Sholto's a rich man. He'll see you're rewarded.
It's a bad job all the same. And so Mr. Athelney Jones will think.
Well, we'd better hurry along and break the news to him. Driver?
Yes, sir.
221B Baker Street.
Quick as you like, sir.
When we reached Baker Street, Holmes, Athelney Jones, and their prisoner had only just arrived, having changed their plans so far as to report at the station on the way. My companion lounged in his armchair with his usual listless expression, and Small sat stolidly opposite him, with his wooden leg cocked over his sound one. As I exhibited the empty box, he leaned back in his chair with a look of exultation.
Yes, I've put the treasure where you'll never lay hand on it. If I can't have the loot, I'll take darn good care no one else does.
Tell us where it is at once.
You'll find the treasure where the key is and where little Tonga is. When I saw your launch was going to catch us, I put it away in a safe place. Oh, there are no reprieves for you on this journey.
You are deceiving us, Small. If you would wanted to throw the treasure in the Thames, you'd have done it box and all.
Oh, no. The man that's clever enough to hunt me down is clever enough to pick an iron box in the bottom of the river. Now they're scattered over 5 miles or so, you may find it a harder job.
This is a very serious matter, Small. If you would help justice instead of thwarting
justice.
It, I might have...
This loot belongs to me and 3 other men. Is it justice to give it up to people who never earned it? Look how I've earned it. 20 long years in chains, working in a fever-ridden swamp, bitten by mosquitoes, racked with ague. I tell you, I'd rather have one of Tonga's darts in my side than live to see another man enjoying the money that's mine.
Now, wait a minute. You're forgetting that we know nothing of all this.
And why should I tell you, Mr. Holmes?
Because then we shall know how much justice you may have had on your side.
Oh. Well, sir, you've been very fair spoken to me. If you want the story, I won't hold it back. Could you put a glass beside me here so that I can get my hands to it if I'm dry?
By all means.
Now don't get up, Holmes. I'll do it.
Oh, thank you, sir. Well, I'm a Worcestershire man, born near Pershaw. Dare say you'd find a heap of Smalls living there now if you cared to look. I often thought of taking a look round there, but I doubt if my family would have been very glad to see me.
What took you abroad, then? The army?
Yes. Usual story. Got a mess over a girl, took the Queen's shilling. Went out with the 3rd Buffs to India. Wouldn't do much soldiering, though. I just got past the goose step when I was fool enough to go swimming in the Ganges and met a crocodile.
Ah, so that's what happened to your leg.
Yes, that's right, sir. Nipped it off as clean as a surgeon could have done it. I was 5 months in hospital, and when at last I limped out, it was to find myself invalided out of the army and unfitted for any active occupation. Wasn't 20 then, and pretty well down on my luck, as you can imagine. Still, I got a job with an indigo planter. A man named Abel White, who wanted an overseer to look after his coolies. He happened to be a friend of our colonel's.
Well, that was lucky enough.
Yes. But I was never in luck's way long. Suddenly, without a note of warning, the great mutiny broke on us.
You went through that?
Oh, I did indeed, sir. We was at a place called Matra. That's on the border of the northwest provinces. Night after night, the old sky was alight with the burning bungalows. Mr. Abel White had it in his head that the old thing would blow over.
Had he indeed?
Yes, he was a very obstinate man, sir. There he sat on his veranda drinking whiskey pegs with the old country in a blaze about him. And then, of course, one fine day, the crash came. I was riding back from one of the plantations, and I saw the flames coming up through the roof of the bungalow and hundreds of madmen dancing and howling around it. Some of them saw me and a couple of bullets came whizzing past me head. I knew it was too late to do any good, so I broke away across the paddy fields and made for the fort at Agra. The 3rd Bengal Fusiliers was there. The river washes along the front of it, but we had to guard the sides and the back. I was put on night watch with 2 Sikh troopers, tall, fierce-looking chaps, both old fighting men. They was called Amit Singh and Abdullah Khan.
Ah, 2 of your brotherhood of 4.
Yes, that's right, sir. But we hadn't formed any brotherhood yet. They was silent fellas, and for the first 2 nights of our watch, I couldn't get nothing out of them. The 3rd night, about 2 in the morning, they still wouldn't talk, so I took out my pipe, lay down my musket to strike a match. And the next moment, they was on me.
Don't move, or I put this knife in your throat.
Now, what's this all about?
Don't shout. Keep quiet and listen to me.
Well, what do you want, then?
Said, you must be either with us now, or you must be silenced forever. Which is it to be? That or life? We can only give you 3 minutes to decide. All must be done before the rounds come again.
What? How can I decide? You've not told me what you want of me. If it's anything against the safety of the fort, I'll have no truck with it. You can drive home your knife and have done with it.
It is nothing against the fort. They're only asking you to be rich. If you will be one of us this night, we swear by the naked knife and the threefold oath that a quarter of the treasure shall be yours.
What treasure?
Will you swear by the bones of your father, by the honor of your mother, and by the cross of your fate, to raise no hand or to speak no word against us, either now or afterwards?
I'll swear it's not against the safety of the fort.
Then my comrade and I will swear that you shall have a quarter of the treasure, which shall be equally dividing between the four of us.
The four?
Yes. Dost Akbar must have his share. Mohammed Singh.
Achcha.
Go and stand beyond the gate and give notice when the travelers are arriving.
Go, Achcha.
I will tell you the whole story while we are waiting for them.
Well?
There is a Raja in the northern province who has much wealth. When the troubles broke out, he would be friends both with the lion and the tiger. So he kept his gold and silver in the vaults of his palace. But his precious stones and pearls he is putting in an old iron box and sent by a trusty servant who in the guise of a man should take it to this fort to lie here till the land is at peace. Thus, if the rebels won, he would have his money. But if they lost, and if they went to the British, he would still have his jewels. Then he threw himself into the cause of the rebels, by which, mark you, Sahib, his property becomes the due of those who have been true to their salt.
Then Dost Akbar is the servant who's to bring the treasure here?
No. The servant is named Ahmed. Dost Akbar is my foster brother, who is leading him to this gate. The place is lonely. No one will know it is coming.
Then you mean to kill?
Yes, Sahib. The world shall know Ahmed no more. But the treasure will be dividing amongst us. What do you say?
But it's cold murder.
Consider, Sahib. If the man is taken by the commandant, he will be hung or shot. And his jewels taken by the government. They will be as well with us as in the company's coffers. Say again, Sahib. Are you with us? Or must we look upon you as an enemy?
I'm with you.
It is well.
Does your brother know what you mean to do?
The plan is his. He has devised it.
Shh! Here they are.
Yes. You will challenge him, Sahib, as usual. Give him no cause for fear. Send us in with him, and we shall do the rest.
Who goes there?
Friends.
Advance, friends.
Sahib, your protection for the unhappy merchant Ahmed. I have traveled across Rajputana to seek the shelter of the fort of Agra. It is a blessed night when I'm once more in safety. I and my poor possessions.
What you got in that bundle?
Only an old iron box with one or two family matters of no value except to myself. But I am not a beggar. I shall reward you, Sahib, and your governor if you will give me shelter.
Take him to the main guard.
This way.
Gentlemen, I watched the little Ahmed move off with the two tall Sikhs, Abdullah Khan and Mohammed Singh on either side of him. And the third, Dost Akbar, walking behind. Suddenly, the measured tramp of their feet ceased. There was a scuffle and the sound of blows. Then, to my horror, a rush of footsteps in my direction. It was the little man, running like the wind. Behind him, a great black-bearded Sikh, knife in hand. He was gaining on the Sikh, and if he got by me, he might still reach safety. As he raced past, I thrust my firelock between his legs. The little man rode over like a shot rabbit. The Sikh was upon him in a flash and buried his knife twice in his side.
The man never moaned or moved a muscle, but lay where he'd fallen. Ah, you see, gentlemen, I'm keeping my promise. I'm telling you every word exactly as it happened.
It's a horrible story.
On my word.
Savages.
Oh, yes, it was all very bad, no doubt. But it was my life or his. If he'd got out, the old business would have come to light, and I should have been court-martialed and shot as likely as not. People were not very lenient at a time like that.
Go on with your story.
Well, we disposed of his body in a crumbling part of the fort, and then we opened this iron box that's now standing empty on your table and looked at the treasure. Tuh! It was blinded to look on. We took it out and counted it. There was 143 diamonds of the first water, 97 emeralds, 170 rubies, 210 sapphires, and a quantity of bells, onyxes, cat's eyes, and other stones I didn't even know the name of at the time. Oh, and 12 very fine pearls set in a gold chaplet. They'd been taken out of the chest when I recovered it.
Yes, we know about them. Mr. Sholto has been sending them one a year to Miss Morstan. At least something of the treasure escaped you, Mr. Small. But continue, please.
Well, then we renewed our oath, hid the treasure in the fort, and I drew 4 plans, one for each of us. When the mutiny ended, we was just thinking we could go off with the plunder when we was all arrested for the murder of Achmet, whose body had been found.
But not the jurors.
I know. And not a word about him came out of the trial. You see, in the meantime, the Rajah had been deposed and driven out of India, so no one had any particular interest in him. The murder, however, was clearly made out, and it was certain that all 4 of us must have been involved. The 3 Sikhs got penal servitude for life. I was condemned to death. They commuted it to the same as the others.
So there you were, with the treasure safely hidden, but all 4 tied by the leg.
That's how it was, sir. It's enough to make a man eat his heart out. So I just held on and bided me time. And then I had a stroke of luck. We was transferred to Blair Island in the Andamans.
What was so lucky about that? I always thought it was a terrible hole.
Yes, it's certainly that, sir. But there was very few white convicts, and I soon got privileges. One of them was to dispense drugs for the surgeon, Dr. Summerton. He was a fast, sporting sort of chap, and the other young officers would meet in his rooms of an evening and play cards. There was Major Sholto and Captain Morstan.
Ah! Now it begins to fit.
There was also 2 or 3 prison officials, crafty old hands. When I was in the surgery, I sometimes used to turn out the lights so that I could listen to their talk and watch their play. One thing very soon struck me, which was that the soldiers always used to lose and the civilians used to win.
How very unfortunate for the soldiers.
Yes, it was indeed, sir. Major Sholto was so hard hit that he came to sign in notes for big sums. One night, when he'd lost more heavily than usual, I heard him and Captain Morstan talking as they went by my window.
It's all up, Morstan. I shall have to hand in my papers. I'm a ruined man.
Nonsense, old chap. I've had a nasty face on myself. But just keep playing. The luck can't run against us forever.
No, I suppose not.
Well, that was all I could hear. It was enough to set me thinking. Then, a couple of days later, Major Sholto was strolling on the beach, and I took the chance of speaking to him.
Well, Small, what is it?
I wanted to ask you, sir, who's the proper person to hand over hidden treasure to?
Huh?
I know where there's 500,000.
Half a million, Small?
Yes, quite that, sir, in jewels and pearls. The queer thing is, the owner's outlawed, so it belongs to the first comer.
Well, it must go to government, Small, to government.
Then you think, sir, I ought to give the information to the Governor General?
Well, you mustn't do anything rash. Let me hear about it, Small. Give me the facts.
I told him the old story, with little changes so that he couldn't identify places. Then 2 nights later, he and his friend, Captain Morstan, came to my hut in the dead of night with a lantern.
Now, look here, Small. I've been talking this matter over with the captain here, and we feel that perhaps it is hardly a government matter after all. In fact, we might be inclined to take it up ourselves if we could agree on terms. Isn't that so, Morstan?
Yes, certainly. The point is, Small, what price would you ask for your secret?
The price would be my freedom and that of my three companions. Then we could take you into partnership and give you a fifth share between you.
A fifth? Oh, that's not very tempting.
It'd come to 50,000 apiece.
But how can we gain your freedom? You know that's quite impossible.
Oh, no, nothing of the sort, sir. I've thought it all out. You've only got to bring a yacht over from Calcutta or Madras. We'll get aboard by night and you can drop us in any part of the Indian Ocean you please.
It's a dirty business. But as you say, Sholto, the money will save our commissions handsomely.
Well, Small, I suppose we must try to meet you. First, of course, we must test your story. Tell me where the box is hidden and I'll get a month's leave of absence and go and locate it.
Oh, no, not so fast. I must have the consent of my three comrades.
Oh, nonsense. Those three fellows needn't come into it.
It's none or all. We've sworn to act together.
Oh, very well, then. Bring them all to us and we'll come to an arrangement.
Well, gentlemen, I know my friend Mr. Jones is impatient to get me safely stowed in Chokee, so I'll make the rest of my story as short as I can. The villain Sholto went off to India and never came back again. He went on to England, taking the treasure with him.
How did you know that?
Captain Morstan saw his name in a mailboat's passenger list, and then went over to Agra himself and found the treasure gone. From that moment, I lived only for vengeance. To track down Sholto and to have my hands on his throat was my one thought. But it was many years before my time came.
How did you make your escape eventually?
Oh, that was through Tonga, the little Andaman Islander. He'd been picked up ill by a convict gang in the woods. I nursed the little fella back to Elf. He took a kind of fancy to me. He owned a big, roomy canoe of his own and was a fine boatman. When I saw he'd do anything for me, I talked him into our making a run for it together.
Were there no guards to stop
him? We set off at night from an old, disused wharf. Only one guard stood in our way. I crept up to him from behind, unstrapped my wooden leg and struck him down before he could put carbine to shoulder.
Good heavens alive.
He was at sea for 10 days. Then we was picked up by a trader going from Singapore to Jeddah with a cargo of Malay pilgrims. Oh, they was a rum crowd. They let us alone and asked no questions. It took us many years to get to England.
But how did you live?
By exhibiting Tonga in fairs and circuses all over the world. Then, at long last, we arrived in London. It didn't take me long to find out where Major Sholto lived. I made friends with someone in the house who could help me.
Who was that, pray?
I name no names, Mr. Holmes.
Oh.
I don't want to get anybody else into an hole. Well, then I got word he was dying and hurried to the house, mad that he should slip out of my clutches. His jaw dropped when he saw me looking in at the window, and I knew he was a goner. I got into his room that night, though, and searched everywhere for some sign of the treasure. And left the sign of four as a mark of our hatred.
And the same informant told you when the treasure had been found?
Yes. And by that time, I knew the layout of the house as well. So I brought Tonga along with a long rope coiled round his waist. And he climbed in and killed Mr. Bartholomew before I could stop him. Well, it's the truth, gentlemen. And I've told it to let you know how badly I've been served by Major Sholto. I'd have swung for him with a light heart. But I swear to you, I'm innocent of the death of his son.
Very remarkable account. A fitting wind-up to an extremely interesting case.
I quite agree.
One point. I had hoped that Tonga had lost all his darts, but he managed to shoot one at us in the boat.
He had lost them all, sir, except the one that was in his blowpipe at the time.
Ah, of course, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to ask about, sir?
I think not, thank you.
Well, Holmes, we all know you're a connoisseur of crime. But duty's duty, and I'll feel more at ease when we have our storyteller here under lock and key.
Very well.
I'm much obliged to you both for your assistance. And of course, we'll both be wanted at the trial. Good night to you.
Good night.
Good night, Inspector.
Good night, gentlemen, both. After you, sir.
No, you first, Small. I'll take particular care you don't club me with your wooden leg, whatever you may have done to that gentleman in the Andaman Isles.
Well, and there's the end of our little drama. I fear, my dear fellow, it may be the last investigation in which I shall have the chance of studying your methods.
Oh?
Yes. And Miss Morstan has done me the honor to accept me as a husband in prospective.
Oh, I feared as much. I really cannot congratulate you.
Have you any reason to be dissatisfied with my choice?
Not at all. I think she's one of the most charming young ladies I ever met.
Oh, thank you.
She might have been most useful in work such as we have been doing. She had a decided genius that way. Witness the way she preserved the Agra plan from all the other papers of her father.
Quite.
But love is an emotional thing, and whatever is emotional is opposed to that true, cold reason which I place above all things. I should never marry myself lest I bias my judgment.
I trust my judgment may survive the ordeal. But, you look weary.
Yes. The reaction's upon me already. I shall be as limp as a rag for a week.
Strange how terms of what in another man I should call laziness alternate with your fits of splendid energy and vigor.
Yes. There are the makings in me of a very fine loafer and also of a pretty spry sort of fellow. Oh, by the way, apropos of this Norwood business, you noticed that they had, as I surmised, a Confederate in the house.
Yes, he admitted that, even if he wouldn't identify him.
It could be none other than Lao Rao, the Indian servant. So Jones actually had the undivided honor of having caught one fish in his great haul.
The division seems rather unfair. You've done all the work in this business. I get a wife out of it. Jones gets the credit. What remains for you?
For me? There is always my violin. Pass it over to me. There's a good fellow. Thank you.
That ends The Sign of Four by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. The part of Sherlock Holmes was played by Richard Herndl, Dr. Watson by Brian Coleman, Athelney Jones by Hayden Jones, and Jonathan Small by Lee Crutchley. The story was adapted for broadcasting by Felix Felton and produced for the BBC by Archie Campbell.